Concert for Europe gathering in North America, in Washington, D.C. specifically, a continent of leaders gathering in the White House to flank Volodymyr Zelensky, but also to kiss the feet of Donald Trump, desperately trying to persuade him that it is not in his interest to cede ground to Russia, and indeed it is not Ukraine which is the impediment to peace. Boris Johnson, at the start of this terrible war, said Russia's invasion must fail and be seen to fail. At the end of today, will that be the case? Are the rules of international statecraft about to be rewritten, that might is right with the seal of the President of the United States?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, President Trump has ruled out NATO membership for Ukraine ahead of crucial talks with Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington later. Donald Trump, who will also meet Sir Keir Starmer and other European leaders separately, said the retaking of occupied Crimea is also off the table. But reports suggest that Ukraine could be offered security guarantees as part of any truce with Russia. Speaking to LBC this morning, Government Minister Stephen Kinnock has warned that Vladimir Putin has a history of violating agreements.
The only treaty that is going to be credible and robust is one that is backed up by a security guarantee. It's very encouraging to see the United States making positive noises about joining a transatlantic European security guarantee. And that is going to be crucial, because without that, any agreement's not worth the paper it's written on, frankly, when it comes to President Putin.
Despite the planned talks, fighting has continued between Russia and Ukraine. Officials in Kharkiv say Russian drones have killed at least three people overnight. Riot police in Israel have clashed with demonstrators outside the headquarters of the Prime Minister's Likud party. Thousands of people have been protesting against the war in Gaza, demanding a deal for a ceasefire and release of hostages. Benjamin Netanyahu has criticised the protests, though, saying they will only harden Hamas's stance. It's claimed poor training has led to British manufacturing lagging behind global leaders in robotics and AI for the past two decades. Make UK says further investment is needed in digital skills if small and medium-sized firms are to grow. Seamus Nevin is from the manufacturing group behind the report and has spoken to LBC News.
We found when speaking to British manufacturers that in the past, there have been instances where a company has adopted a new technology but hasn't necessarily had the skills in-house to optimise use of that technology. And therefore, the investment, the return on investment hasn't been what they expected. So if we continue to fall further and further behind in terms of technological adoption, we'll also fall further and further behind in terms of economic growth and living standards and wages too.
The government says it is taking action to remove barriers to growth. A new figure suggests eight pubs shut their doors for good across the UK every week over the first half of 2025. Official government data shows 209 were demolished or converted for other uses in the 6 months to June. Reasons cited for closure include rising tax and labour costs. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading up a point at 91.40. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, widespread sunshine will develop after a cloudy start, the risk of a few heavy and thundery downpours in the southwest, highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well, you're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Well, a very good morning to you. It's Lewis Goodall sitting in for the great James O'Brien all this week here on LBC. The time is 10:03, and we could be facing an inner day which we look back on as a pivotal one. A pivotal one, certainly in the long conflict now of the Russia-Ukraine war, going on for 3.5 years, but in reality going on for 10 years since 2014 and the invasion of Crimea, and really, in one sense or another, unfolding since the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the USSR in 1991. When historians look back on this period, I'm sure that they will conclude that the Ukraine war was part of a thread, a thread and a tapestry of European history, of unsolved problems since the fall of the USSR. Because, of course, since the collapse, and that was an extraordinary event. Sometimes we look back and we think of it just as inevitable. It was not inevitable. We had never before seen a political entity of that size, a superpower, collapse pretty much without a shot being fired. Mikhail Gorbachev, the last chairman of the USSR, could be said to have should take a lot of credit for that. It could have been very different. It could have been like China and Tiananmen Square, where a communist regime decided to try and cling on by its fingertips down the barrel of a gun. That did not happen. The USSR collapsed. It, in the end, collapsed into a series of successor states. And that is why we've ended up at today, because some people, including and most importantly of all, Vladimir Putin, never got over it, never got over the humiliation, as they saw it, of the USSR choosing to scuttle itself into the history books without so much as a fight. We look at it as a moment of triumph for the West, for liberalism, for democracy, all of those states which had been kept strangled, their aspirations strangled, people who were not allowed to have their own nation because of people's ambition, people like Stalin, despots, deciding to try and keep these nations under the foot in the yoke of Soviet communism. We look at that as a triumph. There are people, including Putin, who see it, as I say, as a complete humiliation. He was stationed as a junior KGB officer in Dresden, in what was then East Germany, as he saw with horror, watching these nations which had been suppressed by his own people and his own government rise up and take their independence. That is ultimately what today is about, what Ukraine is about, what the invasion was about in 2014 and 2022. It is about Putin trying to reclaim some of what he sees as the honour and glory of Russian days and years past. It is about the difference between colonialism, imperialism, and the rights of nations to set their own future. The truth is that people like Vladimir Putin have never accepted the right of states like Poland, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Ukraine to chart their own course. And the long history, the 30 years or so since the fall of the USSR, has been about Russia and about Putin in particular doing what he can to try and address what he sees as the historical wrong and humiliation of the collapse of the USSR. He cannot in his bones accept that the Ukrainians are a free and independent people with the right to choose their own future, whether that's with the West or with the Russian East. And the fact that so often they have elected, literally and figuratively, to choose the West, to choose the EU, to choose NATO, to choose Europe over the East, he cannot comprehend. He believes every time they do that, that it must be some bit of trickery, some bit of political mastery that the Europe is trying to pull off in some way, some dirty tricks. It is not. What he cannot accept is that these people have chosen or want to choose to be in a different club to Russia, because honestly, why would they not? Why would they choose autocracy and kleptocracy and oligarchy over democracy, freedom, and the rights of self-determination? That is what today is about. And what is worrying, and what we must worry about, and the thing that I go in today to with some trepidation, and I think this is why so many European leaders have chosen to decamp, to break up their summer holidays, to do something completely unprecedented, which is to descend en masse, basically to a meeting that was not even their own, to go to Washington, D.C. I think those European leaders are worried that Donald Trump, who I will give some credit to in I think being genuine in wanting to end the bloodshed, but is worried that Trump will do that at any cost, that he has been persuaded by Vladimir Putin that it is not Europe and Ukraine that is the problem here, that it is Russia that is not the problem, it is Europe and Ukraine which is the impediment to peace. That is what we're fighting here. That is what today is about. It is about two competing visions of history and two competing visions of the future. To give you an idea about what I mean about that Russian interpretation of history, some of you may have heard that my show yesterday, Sunday with Lewis Goodall on LBC from 10 till 12, you know, I'll get the plug in. I spoke to Alexander Vasilev, Vasilev is a former KGB officer. I put some of these points about the rights of Ukrainian self-determination to him. This is part of our exchange. Would you agree that Ukraine has a right to self-determination?
Generally, yes.
Then why is your president not respecting that right?
The thing is that... Let's talk about Crimea. Have you ever been to Crimea?
No. I've not been to lots of places that have been invaded. I'm not sure
Crimea
why it's germane.
Became
I can't go to Crimea. I would have liked to go, but unfortunately your country decided to illegally annex it.
Yes, look.
Well, it's true.
What is important to understand, if you want to understand anything about the events in Ukraine, is that Ukraine, within the borders of 1991, was a creation of the Soviet regime. There was no such thing.
Are you saying that there was no such thing as the Ukrainian people?
Ukrainian people...
They've existed for centuries, separate to Russia.
Do you know anything about President Zelensky?
Yes.
President Zelensky didn't speak Ukrainian at all.
Yeah, okay.
He started learning Ukrainian.
Yeah, there's no doubt. There's no doubt that huge parts of eastern Ukraine have had long-standing cultural, linguistic, political affinity to Russia, which your country...
Thank you.
We know indeed, but your country has now alienated all of those people. They hate you now. They hate you because you've invaded them, you've killed their children, you've kidnapped their children. They loathe you, they abhor you.
During the operation in Crimea, no one was killed, not a single person. Why? Because people wanted
what?
This.
What?
Not a single person was killed during the operation in Crimea
right.
in 2014. Why? Because people wanted this.
No, they didn't. Your country, your government set up an illegal and entirely improper election, referendum, quote-unquote, which delivered a massive margin in favour of the annexation. Look, the thing is, Mr. Vasilev, if the Ukrainians wanted to be part of Russia, they could be. They would be, but they don't want it. I know this is hard for you to get your head around. They don't want it. They don't want you. They don't like you. That was my conversation there with Alexander Vasilyev. If you want to hear it in full, of course, you can listen back to Sunday with Lewis Goodall via Global Player. I want to talk to you this morning about where you think we might be by the end of the day. Boris Johnson, not someone I would quote all of the time, certainly with any particular relish, but nonetheless, Boris Johnson had it on the money back in 2022 when he was Prime Minister at the start of this war, when he said that however this ended, whenever this ended, and nobody could know or perhaps expected that it would still be going on 3 years later when he said it, but he said that however it ended, this war, Russia, with this war, Russia must fail and must be seen to fail. Will that be the case at the end of today or the end of this week? Or do you think, perhaps, that we'll be no further forward by then? 0345-6060-973. 0345-6060-973. Text WhatsApp 84850. Let's speak now to the Hanna Hopko, who's the former head of the Foreign Affairs Committee of the Ukrainian Parliament, co-founder International Centre for Ukrainian Victory. Hanna, thanks so much for joining us this morning. Where do you think we'll be by the end of the day?
So, Ukrainian armed forces will keep defending Ukraine with American support or without. Ukrainian people will never surrender. And actually, we have to remind Trump that during the first term of his presidency, there was a Crimean declaration, well known as a Pompeo declaration. So actually, United States forced Ukraine, when Soviet Union collapsed, to give up nuclear weapons, cruise missiles, all strategic bombers. So actually, they promised us to protect Ukrainian territorial integrity and sovereignty. And I think it's a time to remind all the commitments, obligations, assurances, I would prefer to say guarantees. So in this regard, I hope Ukrainian president, together with European allies, will try to deliver this message, because Alaska was a disaster, and it's clear that now Trump demanding Zelensky to accept a capitulation and blaming that not ending to war, it's America taking Russian side.
Do you think that when the Americans talk about security guarantees, or this is the briefing that we're getting from the White House, is there, given the history, the rather poor and checkered history of Western guarantees, security guarantees to the West, going back to the Budapest Memorandum, of course, in 1994, which clearly been broken. Russia was also a signatory to that, ironically enough. But do you think that there is going to be sufficient trust in Ukraine to believe that those security guarantees would be honoured?
let's be frank, the West weak response to Russia's threat to international peace has catalyzed the imploding of the global security order. So what we are facing now, we are facing an emboldened Sino-Russian alliance, which strongly believes that there is a window of opportunity to gain the power to set the rules of new and free world ruled by force. Because when Russia started its aggression back in 2014, Russia acted alone, sending green men to Crimea. So now, for the first time in 21st century, there is Asian troops from North Korea in the European theater. So we need to understand that it's really important. It's not about Russian imperialism. It's about Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, with their goal to destroy the Western civilization. And honestly, Ukrainians, we don't buy any security guarantees when we see no signs from Russian side actually to implement ceasefire, to return back Ukrainian kids. And I heard the previous speaker in your program. So sorry, everyone who visited Kyiv seen the St. Sophia Cathedral, which was built at the beginning of 11th century when Moscow didn't exist.
Putin has suggested that the price for peace would be Ukraine ceding not just the territory in the Donbass that Putin and Russia already control, but indeed all of the Donbass, and indeed about a third of that is currently not under his control. Is there any way, is there any way, do you think, that Ukraine, that would ever be acceptable to Ukraine?
Look, Russia's goal is not just seizing land. It's dismantling Ukrainian statehood, Ukrainian nation. For centuries, when we were fighting with Russian imperialism, during the Soviet Union, when Stalin organized a famine, a man-made Holodomor, and now it happened during the Soviet Union. Now Russian Federation for 11 years committing aggression, which is genocidal war. So, but what I would like to say is that aggressor is stuck because Russia managed to occupy less than 1% of our territory during the last 1,000 days. So actually, of course, they want us to give up Donetsk region or Donbass territories without a fight. But it's not about ending the war. It's about preparing for bigger war, and I would add, beyond Ukrainian territories.
You think that this is a precursor to something bigger?
Look, the history for last 11 years, remember Minsk 1, Minsk 2, when Western allies were telling us, I remember as the former head of the Foreign Relations Committee, Hanna, you shouldn't ask lethal weapon, only political diplomatic solutions. We will manage with Russia. Okay, so now please confiscate Russian sovereign assets, impose tougher sanctions, demand from Russia a comprehensive ceasefire with clear verification mechanisms. But without all these signs, how we can talk about bigger peace deal without any readiness from Russia even to stop bombing us? Rachel Scott, the political correspondent of ABC News, she was right asking Putin, will you stop killing civilians? No, today four civilians were killed in Kharkiv.
Do you, just finally, Hanna, do you trust Trump? Do Ukrainians trust Trump?
So for all the months of second term of presidency of Trump, there is no signs that Trump really wants to achieve sustainable peace and that he is on Ukrainian or even an American side. Because it's not in American national interest now to flatter Putin with all this dancing or dirty dances in Alaska and all these so-called peace talks.
Hanna Hopko there, former head of the Foreign Affairs Committee for the Ukrainian Parliament, giving us her assessment of where we are today. Want your assessment as well as to where we might be by the end of today. Will the Russian war be seen to have failed by the end of today? And do you trust Donald Trump not to sell out European security? And is that why all of the European leaders are going there en masse? Are they worrying? Are they panicked? 0345-6060973. 0345-6060973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien. All this week on LBC, the time is 10:19.
LBC.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools, and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions, or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
At This Vet, me as the owner, surgeon, rota manager, and puppy wrangler, and now she and her team are cybersecurity experts too.
Mia, someone tried accessing our system. Phishing scam. I blocked it.
BT Security Awareness Training turns your team into your first line of defense. Quick to set up from just £1.25 per user per month. Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Thankfully, not just Mia's. Search BT Business Cybersecurity. T&Cs apply. Prices exclude VAT at 20%. 12-month minimum term applies.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Body pain might not sound like this. Or this. But it might sound like this.
I'm fine.
Hiding your body pain behind a smile? Let us help. With up to 12 hours of uninterrupted muscle and joint pain relief. Voltarol, the joy of movement. Voltarol Joint and Back Pain Relief 2.3% gel contains diclofenac diethylammonium. Always read the label.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 6060973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 10:21. Let's talk to Peter in Wimbledon, who has something to say about what's going on today in Washington. Peter, good morning.
Hey, good morning to you, Lewis. One thing I would like to mention is that since Trump came into power, it was obviously clear to myself and people who know about Trump and looked into his dealings with Russians in the past that in the end of the process, they're all going to be framed to make Zelensky look like a scapegoat, like a person who doesn't want to negotiate. Mm. Attempts were made to look like he's not a legitimate leader and kind of trying to remove him from power. And obviously this was not possible because majority of people would not in Ukraine, even opposition leaders, would like him to remain in power while the war is still going on with his proven record, you know. If you look at the Trump as a person, you will find a bit deeper. Steve Witkow, his chief negotiator, property developer, who went to Kremlin to see Putin, he's got very close business ties with Blavatnik, who is a Russian oligarch with the Kremlin ties, very close. Donald Trump failing businesses in the 90s were bailed out with Russian money. And there is a strong rumors among the intelligence community that Putin has a copy of the Epstein files. It's not a surprise to me that to see Trump acting the way he's acting, rolling out a red carpet. It's a surprise to me that the Western allies of Ukraine in Europe are kind of sleepwalking into it, hoping that Trump will change, but knowing quite well that nothing different is going to be we can expect from Trump.
Well, maybe they don't. I suspect they don't hope or think that he'll change, Peter, but maybe they just think that they've got to try and maximise their chances of persuading him that it is Russia and not Ukraine that is the impediment to war. Because we know Trump does tend to have a history of sort of just believing the last person to whom he was speaking. So it's entirely possible that they're hoping to course correct what happened on Friday.
Well, they can hope. But at the end of the day, the guy is very weak on details. He has got no knowledge of anything. He's got no knowledge of politics. To him, it's just a deal who's benefiting him personally. And clearly, Putin can offer Trump a thousand times more what Europe and Ukraine can offer him. And that's all that matters to Trump. And the other thing is the compromise the Kremlin has on Trump clearly plays its part as well. So we are in a moment in history where we need a Churchillian leader in Europe who can actually unite Europe, not just in words and big kind of... We need actions from European leaders, realizing that the reason this war is not on the doorstep of Europe and Britain is purely because Ukrainian army are stopping the Russian invaders as we speak. And they've been doing it for 3.5 years. It's a shame on European community that we are still negotiating what sort of our GDP, percentage of GDP should be sent to Ukraine and so on, because those brave Ukrainian men and women are actually giving their lives now, basically. If Putin succeeded and if things went on as he planned, Lewis, that we would not be talking about this now, because the Russian army would have not suffered the losses they've suffered in Ukraine. And if they captured Ukraine and Ukraine become part of Russia, okay, then that army would have marched through Europe without any resistance, especially if Trump's in power.
Okay, Peter in Wimbledon, grateful to see you. If you agree, 0345-6060-973. Let's speak first to Fabrice Potier, a former head of policy planning in NATO under the former Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen, and Jens Stoltenberg, now Chief Executive Officer of Rasmussen Global. Fabrice, thanks so much for joining us this morning. What do you think, getting inside the head of European leaders, also, of course, the incumbent Secretary General Mark Rutte, what do you think they are hoping to achieve in decamping en masse to the White House in this extraordinary and, as far as I can remember, unprecedented kind of way?
Yes, it's unprecedented, I think, because the stakes could not be higher for Europe, quite frankly. I think what everybody is trying to achieve here is to turn President Trump's failure in Alaska, in the Alaska summit, and avoid him leaning too hard on President Zelensky for him to make too many concessions, and turn this into more a positive concession in the sense of U.S. commitment to Ukrainian security. I think with this in the pocket, on his way back to Ukraine, President Zelensky will be in a much stronger position to negotiate with his Russian counterpart. Without that, and having to make some hard territorial compromise under U.S. pressure, I think President Zelensky will be in a very perilous position.
How do you think Trump will respond to this mass sort of exodus from Europe and arrival in Washington of all of these leaders? Would you think he'll? Do you think he may feel a sort of rail against it in the sense of being sort of pressured into something, or that he'll enjoy the feeling of sort of all of these courtiers arriving at the court of King Trump and trying to persuade him of something?
Well, I think you frame it very well. I think there's a very thin line between him feeling flattered to be at the center of so much, you know, world leaders' attention, to him being cornered and forced into making decisions or giving some commitments he doesn't want to do. You know, a bully never wants to feel cornered. Mm. And President Trump essentially is a geopolitical bully. So I think this is really about that thin line, which I trust, you know, Secretary General Rutte, UK Prime Minister Starmer and other leaders to get right and to help Zelensky in framing the conversation into not Ukraine making concessions, but about Ukraine having the assets it needs to come to a proper peace that is just and that is sustainable.
In terms of what might happen either now or next in the future on this question of security guarantees, is there a way of persuading Russia and Putin that they are credible and that they would genuinely be a deterrent? Because obviously, you know, there has been a move in the White House, at least from some of the briefing, is to perhaps backing some form of guarantee or assurance, although we have no idea about what the detail might be. Europe's own defence capacity remains relatively limited, or at least not adequate to fulfil what would be necessary to act as a deterrent to Russia. Is there a way of convincing Russia that it would be a genuine deterrent and it would deter?
There are three critical ingredients to get this right and to answer your question by the positive. First, you need to have Ukraine with the maximum capabilities and capacity to defend itself. That's the first line of defense. So the military aid and the defense investment made in Ukraine are critical to security guarantees. The second layer is, you mentioned, and the Europeans making some real commitments, including as far as possibly deploying European forces on Ukrainian ground. But third, and this is the critical piece that has been missing, is U.S. guarantees, potentially to guarantee the European deployment or to come at the last minute, you know, in case of very significant existential threat. I think if you get these three ingredients right, and again, the devil is in the detail, you can have some deterrence effect vis-a-vis President Putin. If you get them wrong, or if one is missing, I don't think Putin will take this seriously, and he will carry on waging his war.
The context to all of this, of course, is important, which is we're 3.5 years into the full-scale invasion, and the war, certainly for 12 months, 18 months or so, has not been going brilliantly for Ukraine, not catastrophically, but Russia has been on the advance, albeit slowly and at enormous cost. How long do you think, what is your assessment of, assuming this war were to go on for another 6 months or 12 months, what the state of play would be? Do you buy the assessment that Putin, that Trump certainly seems to be buying, which is that Ukraine is losing the war and will lose the war?
I don't know. I think to make a final determination is rushing into conclusion here. I think the problem is both sides are neither winning nor losing. And both sides have assets and capabilities and also vulnerabilities. The biggest one for Ukraine is its demography, where it has a much smaller pool of resources, human resources, to reinforce its military, whilst Russia's vulnerability is that, like you said, they have not managed to make a lot of advance, and the few kilometers, square kilometers they have won were at huge cost, sometimes up to 1,000 soldiers a day. And the Russian economy is running out of steam. So I think both sides have some weaknesses, but the reality, and this is the problem, is not just about the quantitative weaknesses, it's about the political will. And clearly President Putin still has the will to go for it. And that's the key in the Oval Office, in President Trump's hand, is that he's the only one who can deny or constrain this will by putting a huge cost on Putin's action. And the problem is, frankly, President Trump has been unwilling to do so. And that's why President Putin called him bluff in Alaska.
Fabrice Bodier there, former head of policy planning in NATO when Anders Fogh Rasmussen was the Secretary General. Look, there's lots more to get through on this. I want your thoughts on whether this land swap that Trump is talking about, can that ever be okay? Can it ever be okay to ask the Ukrainians to cede land that Russia right now does not even possess? What kind of future precedent does that set for international statecraft? The complete breakdown of the rules-based order we've seen since the war, where basically your country can just come in, invade, take land. Or is that the price for peace? And that's realpolitik. 0345 6060973. More of your calls to come shortly. Plus, we'll take a look at those remarkable protests in Tel Aviv last night. All that and more to come after the latest RBC News headlines at 10:31 with Dominic Ellis.
President Zelensky is in Washington for talks about ending the war in Ukraine. US President Trump has said the return of occupied Crimea and NATO membership for Ukraine won't be offered as part of any truce with Russia. Politicians across Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales have urged Keir Starmer to act now to pressure Israel to end the war in Gaza. In a letter led by the nationalist SDLP party, they say Parliament should be recalled and arms sales to Israel suspended. And a man arrested after the Bournemouth footballer Antoine Semenyo, reported being racially abused, has been released on bail. The forward reported alleged comments made during his side's 4-2 defeat to Liverpool in their Premier League opening game on Friday. LBC weather, widespread sunshine developing after a cloudy morning. The risk of a few heavy showers in the southwest, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Sale now on at AO. Get savings on washing machines, fridge freezers and small kitchen appliances from brands like Dyson, Hisense and AEG. No wonder we're the UK's most trusted electrical retailer. Shop now at AO.com. To verify most trusted, visit AO.com/trust.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name, experts in money, a hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount, promised a great return, took all I had, and then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated, and every month, CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money, so head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
CEL.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. Mm. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 10:34. Just a reminder, just we're going to get an update on the Israel story, what's going on in Gaza in a second. But just a reminder, when we're talking about history, and I can see some Russian bots already messaging in with sort of completely warped versions of what's going on and what has gone on over time. It's not just when we're talking about Russian aggression towards Ukraine. We're not just going back to 2014. We're not just going back to 2014. This is part of a long, long struggle for Ukrainians to exercise and claim their national rights. And time and time again, they have found themselves at the mercy of the butcherous whims of not just Russians or the Soviet Union, as it then was, and I'm talking about the government rather than the people, of course, but also the Nazis in the Second World War. They have found themselves sandwiched repeatedly to poles as well, a history around there as well of appalling bloodshed. Go back to the Soviet Union itself. You had the Holodomor, a man-made famine under Joseph Stalin that killed millions of Ukrainians. Mass repression and purges during the Stalinist period, suppression of Ukrainian churches, the deportation of entire populations to the gulags, the Chernobyl disaster, which was a bit of Soviet incompetence, political interference from the 1990s to the 2000s, heavily meddling in Ukraine's elections going back as far as 2004, the gas wars of 2006, the annexation of Crimea, of course, in 2014, and the ongoing murderous campaign against Ukrainian civilians that we've seen since then, with four people dying even just overnight with the latest Ukrainian or the attacks on Ukraine. So this goes back a long, long way. Let's not forget that. Turning to other parts of the world, tens of thousands of demonstrators have gathered in Tel Aviv to call for an end to the war in Gaza and the release of hostages. This is one of the largest demonstrations in Israel since the start of the fighting in 2023. This was a Sunday evening rally in Tel Aviv, the culmination of a day of nationwide protests and a general strike to pressure the government to halt the military campaign. Bring them all home, stop the war, came the cry in Tel Aviv, converging on so-called Hostage Square in Tel Aviv Plaza. It's become a bit of a focal point for protesters throughout the war. Let's talk now to Noga Tonopolsky, freelance journalist based in Jerusalem, someone to whom we turn often in these sorts of events. Noga, thanks so much for talking to us this morning. This was a very, very large protest, the largest we've seen for a long time.
That's right, Lewis. The estimates are somewhere above 300,000, up to 400,000. That's what the organizers are claiming. And it was a wide-ranging Stop the War rally that was actually spearheaded by family members of people murdered on October 7th, 2023, who demand there be a National Commission of Inquiry, something that Prime Minister Netanyahu has blocked since the beginning of the war, an independent inquest into what happened. But they were quickly joined by hostages' families and hundreds of thousands of sympathizers, and I think general issue Israelis who are fed up with the situation that feels like a grinding, endless war.
What do you think, in terms of the effect that any of this might have on the Israeli government? We have seen protests of, you know, substantial size in the past. We've seen a general strike before. Do you think if it will have any effect on the policy of Benjamin Netanyahu, if any?
That's, you know, the crucial question, obviously. And I have to tell you that at the moment, I don't see any indication that it will impact Prime Minister Netanyahu's government in any way. Yesterday was an interesting day in terms of the messaging from the Israeli government. For the first half of the day, The most of Netanyahu's ministers were mocking the national strike. It wasn't a strike, you know, the way we normally think about it, called by unions, but it was a popular strike. And people not going to work, blocking the roads. And the prime minister came on quite early, full on, strong, and accused the protesters of, in fact, being complicit with Hamas, including former hostages of Hamas, including family members of those still held. And for the rest of the day, the government was basically mocking the protesters, saying, oh, you know, a puny, tiny protest with no one showing up. One of the Prime Minister Netanyahu's allies, Tali Gottlieb, mocked the protesters as being a bunch of unmade up old ladies with gray hair. That was the level. Wow. And yet, by the end of the day, as the magnitude became clear, the government started basically to keep quiet.
Let me just get it straight, because we hear this a lot from the Netanyahu government. Whenever foreign governments, including our own, led by Keir Starmer, criticise the actions of the Israeli government with regards to Gaza, Netanyahu often comes out and says, well, what you're doing is offering succour to Hamas, you're reinforcing them, you're strengthening them. Netanyahu is saying the same thing, and his government is saying the same thing about his own citizens.
That's exactly right. That's exactly the point I was trying to make. You heard me loud and clear about his own citizens, including his own citizens who were victims of his own government's neglect.
Wow.
Citizens who were faced with armed terrorists in their bedrooms on a Saturday morning and kidnapped by those terrorists across the border to Gaza. Including those citizens, the prime minister was unable to muster a gram of empathy or sympathy. And this really does tell you a lot. You know, I'm often asked as a journalist, how is the Israeli government responding when the UK or France or Canada, you know, express disapproval of the Israeli government's actions? And as you said, the government normally responds that they're a bunch of anti-Semites or something of that nature. And the Israeli government thus far has shown itself to be completely and totally immune. And it appears to be operating on a separate space from that of the majority of the Israeli people, and is going in the opposite direction. And I expect that we will see growing clashes, especially when the government, the army, begins calling up reservists so as to man this expansion, the planned expansion of the war.
I have to say, Noga, I mean, there's much which surprises and baffles and astonishes and sometimes horrifies about what has been going on in Israel and Gaza. But the prospect of the government attacking the families of the hostages is, to me, a whole new level.
Israel has become a country that feels a bit like one of those distorted mirrors in a fun park. Except it's a very, very dark fun park. And you're absolutely right. The very things that seem inconceivable, a government attacking its own citizens, abusing them, mocking them for demanding the very basic rights of any citizen, which is keep me safe. That is what is happening today in Israel. And it's really the only news of the day in Israel, the kind of obscenity of the government's reaction in the face of this huge protest. The government is also engaged in actions to try and pretend like the protest didn't happen. And so you will not believe me, but I'm telling you the truth when I say that today the government announced a decision to locate and bring to the surface of the water a ship that was sunk 77 years ago, when Israel was just being formed, as part of the conflict between a kind of the last remnants of a right-wing militia that had fought here against the British and the newly born Israel Defense Forces. And so this very right-wing government is planning to resurface this ship out of the ocean. And that's the only project that's been announced today following the protest.
Astonishing. And meanwhile, Noga, these not just about what is happening in Gaza, but also the West Bank, isn't it? Because we've had the far-right finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, announcing tail end of last week that work would start on a long-delayed settlement that would divide the West Bank and cut it off from East Jerusalem, a move which his office has been very straightforward and open about in saying that it would bury the idea of a Palestinian state because there would be no Palestinian state possible to recognize.
That's right. And as strange as it may seem to you, through this kind of statement, the finance minister thinks he's kind of giving Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron a comeuppance. In his, that the whole statement was aimed, saying we're burying the prospect of a Palestinian state. It was aimed on the one hand kind of to goad the Israeli prime minister to declare sovereignty, which is another word, way of saying to annex the entire West Bank and declare that it is Israeli territory. But he's also, in his mind, responding to the foreign leaders who have said they are considering recognizing a Palestinian state. This is less an indication of policy than an indication of the sorts of characters that Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is on trial for very serious corruption charges, has chosen to surround himself in the cabinet as a way of holding on to power. And remember, he's not just an unpopular prime minister. Right now he heads a government, a real minority government, 49 seats out of 120 they hold right now in the parliament. So this is all just kind of a government by trying to poke other people in the eyes.
And then some news I noticed this morning in the last sort of half an hour, just briefly, Naga, about Hamas being presented with another ceasefire plan. Have you heard about this?
I have heard about it. I think I've heard about it like you have, but I don't know what may be in it. I do know that Egypt and Qatar are really, really making huge efforts right now to try and do something or anything that might stave off this possible Israeli expansion of war. But there are no indications to me right now that either the Israeli side or the Hamas side are interested in any such solution. So I don't know beyond that. The Israeli government and Prime Minister Netanyahu personally have zigzagged even in the last week between saying that they are only willing to negotiate what's called a comprehensive ceasefire, in other words, a deal that would see all of Israel's hostages released, or a partial ceasefire. This is the Israeli terminology, something that would see some of the living hostages released. Either way, there's no indication that Hamas is interested unless Israel accedes to a declaration of the end of the war, which brings us back to the start of our conversation. An end to the war is what hundreds of thousands of Israelis were demanding yesterday on the streets and what the government mocks.
Naga Tonopolsky there, freelance journalist based in Jerusalem. Extraordinary account there of events of the last 24 hours, I think, in Tel Aviv. When you have a government which is not just attacking its own citizens, calling out its own citizens, which is bad enough, but calling out and attacking and criticising the families as the hostages. How many times have we sat here, or have I sat here and talked to you, and you get messages saying, oh, what about the hostages, Lewis? What about the hostages when talking about the humanitarian catastrophe in Hamas? Absolutely, we should be absolutely concerned about the fate of those poor souls who were kidnapped on that dreadful, heinous day. But their own government is attacking the families of those same hostages. Netanyahu's government clearly does not care about their fate because they are accusing the families of strengthening Hamas. That's sick. That has got to be sick. How can you deal? Starmer gets a lot of criticism for what he says about Israel. How can he deal? How could any of us deal with a government like that? If you have any thoughts on that, and of course Ukraine, 0345 60 60 973. You're listening to Lewis Caudle here on LBC, sitting in for James O'Brien. The time is just approaching 10:48.
This is LBC.
When they're away at uni and the show you all love is on telly. When you're miles apart but still laughing at the same joke. When the emojis come thick and fast.
Ah, triple smiley face and a heart.
I knew they'd love that.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. Make sure your child has a TV license when they go to uni, so they're covered to watch all TV channels and you can still enjoy all those TV moments in the family group chat.
Listeners, we interrupt the airwaves to share an incredible discovery. The reason why Britain hasn't been so great of late is because the country hasn't been eating enough Weetabix. We must get to work in rebuilding Great Britain, Bix by Bix. By delivering Weetabix to whoever plans the traffic diversions. To delivery drivers who can't seem to find your house. And people who don't stack the dishwasher properly. To Britain, we must say, have you had your Weetabix?
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus TV only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? 8 years running. Octopus Energy.
Canal Adventures in St Pancras.
That's a new one for us.
Oh, kids, cafe's this way.
Oh, eat your heart out, Venice. This is lovely.
What's that?
Yes, I have both captain hats for the boat ride.
Train back.
So that was two pastries, one boat ride, and no tantrums. Result.
Love this shot of them driving the boat.
Download the Thameslink Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
With over 50 years' experience at Fidelity, we believe there's a difference between investing and being invested. Investing is having access to guidance, tools and expert insights. Being invested means feeling confident about your future. Investing is choosing from a wealth of investment options. Being invested means focusing on your long-term goals. For ISAs, pensions or advice, be truly invested with Fidelity. Go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Leading Britain's conversation, LBC, with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 10:50. If you have any thoughts on how and whether you think the Ukraine war should can end and whether the Ukrainians can possibly see land and whether that can ever be a justification for ending the war. I want to hear from you, 0345 6060973, and perhaps something on Israel as well, given, as we just heard, extraordinary that the Israeli government is being seen and criticised for attacking the families of hostages, for strengthening Hamas, which is a logical leap that I must say escapes me this morning. Mark has got something to say about Ukraine, though, and is in Budapest. Mark, good morning.
Hi, Lewis. The way we look at things in this part of the world is, first of all, we don't want the war to continue. Absolutely not. We also believe a lot of the facts you have in the West are completely wrong because they're not balanced. There's no balance in any facts at all.
Well, facts can't be balanced. Facts aren't balanced by definition, are they? They're facts one way or the other. It's just true.
That's true. Sorry, you're absolutely right. Opinions. I apologise.
Yeah.
Ukraine is in trouble and there's many more dead on the Ukrainian side than is ever being reported at the moment. We know that. We know that they're enlisting now 15-year-olds and people over 45. To fight this war, we know it's just absolutely collapsing.
Well, there can be no doubt, Mark. You're right that Russia has got a bigger manpower reserve to draw on. Although we know that Putin has had no regard for the lives of his own soldiers, sending them into the meat grinder of the war. But we also know that although Russia has been on the advance, much of the progress is very, very slow.
It is very slow, but the reason this war continued after 2013 was because of actions of Ukraine and actions of Europe and actions of NATO. It wasn't due to the Russians.
The Russians invaded, Mark.
This is not reported.
Let's just go back for a second. I mean, okay, we can have a longer debate about the long-term origins of the war, if you like. But the truth is that only one man and one country decided to send the troops in that day, and it was Putin. So you would accept that Russia started the war.
Russia started the war,
okay.
But why did Zelensky tell all the people who spoke Russian that they couldn't even learn Russian anymore?
Well, that was Zelensky is a Russian speaker himself.
From the country.
Zelensky is a native Russian speaker himself.
He tried to stop all of them from speaking Russian,
and
he tried to stop the Hungarians from speaking Hungarian in the same country.
Well, Mark, the thing
is, Ukrainian had to be the main language.
Well, Mark, shall I tell you this? One thing, I mean, it's absolutely true that Eastern Ukraine has long-standing political, cultural, linguistic links to Russia, absolutely true. But we now know, of course, that it's exactly those regions, the regions which were most pro-Russia, who are now most anti-Russia. Why? Because those are the bits that have been bombed to bits in the name of, quote-unquote, saving them from Ukrainians by Russia, by Putin, which makes no sense.
That's not quite as true as you think it is.
What? But it is. Well, what bit of that is untrue?
The propaganda of it.
What propaganda?
I mean, you know that this will happen. The previous caller said that...
Would you disagree with the simple fact that Russia has bombed eastern Ukraine to bits?
No. I also have a daughter-in-law who's from Donbass. I have a daughter-in-law from Donbass.
Have you seen what's happened to Mariupol? There's nothing left of it.
Yes. But isn't that the same as Dresden in the war and things of that nature?
Okay. Well, that's okay. That's all right,
No. I live in a country like Hungary. You were talking about history before, where Hungary lost 70% of its land.
Are you really comparing Ukraine to Nazi Germany?
No.
Well, you just did, because we bombed Dresden, which, by the way, I think was an awful thing to do. But we bombed Dresden.
It was a dreadful thing to do, yes.
We bombed Dresden in the war because we were trying to defeat Nazism, which was a very noble thing to be trying to do. Are you really saying, therefore, that those two things are equivalent?
No, I'm not.
Well, then why bring up Dresden?
Because you wanted an example of a city where it had been bombed like crazy.
Well,
and
I didn't.
They came up with Dresden.
Well, I didn't ask for that actually, but you just brought it up. But what I'm trying to get to, your contention is that Eastern Ukraine hasn't been bombed to bits, and I'm telling you, we all know that it has.
Let me carry on a second, please. I think the war has to finish. There's no doubt about that. And the way this will finish is that Ukraine will be something like Austria was in the 50s when it was ceded to the West. And it's even still today a neutral power. Even today, Austria is not part of NATO.
Yeah.
And what we'll have is probably some demarcation zone of 2 miles where no one's allowed to go, and European troops under the name of the United Nations, not under the name of NATO probably, who will actually patrol that. That seems to me the way this is going to go through. And also, we, as Hungary and many other countries, will massively object to Ukraine ever being part of the European Union. That's never going to. Economically, it doesn't make any sense. They're too poor.
Hungary should never have joined the EU because it was too poor.
Hungary was a lot better than the Ukraine.
Because it's got a lot richer because it joined the EU, which is what Ukraine wants. Hungary was poor when it joined the EU, Mark. It's still relatively poor by comparison to the West, but it was poor when it joined the EU, and it's been a great success story. Seems a bit churlish for the Hungarians not to allow the Ukrainians to do the same thing.
We did a lot of privatizations and everything like that, and we got the country right.
Well, Ukraine could do that as well.
I was involved in that 30 years ago.
Ukraine could do that as well. Anyway, we're going down a bit of a sidetrack. My question to you is do you think that... where do you think we'll be by the end of today?
I think by the end of today, Trump is just acting as a negotiator. He's a business guy. He's not a politician, not in a million years. And what we'll get today is a situation whereby the Europeans will say, we will guarantee the defence of it all, and America will be the backstop, and a deal will be struck. They'll force Zelensky into some sort of deal, because there's no option. What's the option? The option is we carry on fighting for the next 2 years.
All right. Mark there in Budapest. Just as a point of information as well, by the way, this thing comes up a lot, this trope about Zelensky trying to ban Russian. He never tried to ban a Russian in Ukraine. There were certain restrictions applied in certain public cultural places. Some of them, there were specific targets of what was considered to be sort of Russian language propaganda stations, and they had to be supported by fact checkers. But President Zelensky did not ban or try to ban the Russian language. Indeed, instead, laws under his tenure strengthened the role of Ukrainian in public life, but it was not about banning Russian. It's just a little bit of Kremlin talking points propaganda that we hear quite a bit of. Mark is in Tamworth. Mark.
Hello, are you all right? Right. One thing that I've been following up is the Ukrainian crisis. I think Vladimir, because he's an ex-KGB guy, he knows how to work people and exploit their weaknesses, which is why he's rolled over Trump. The only way to deal with it is for NATO to get tough. Mm. And that means, as much as I hate to say it, boots on the ground. Because it's the only language Putin understands.
In terms of what, Mark? Active war? Taking the Russians on? What do you mean?
Basically, keeping the two apart.
Right. Well, I mean, the problem with that is, of course, is that Putin won't accept it. And Putin will see it as a provocation.
Putin will not accept it, but he's going to have to. Because that's the only way it will stop. Simply drip-feeding arms to Ukraine isn't going to do it. Giving Russia Crimea and the Donbass is like, oh, I can use force. I can get what I want. So maybe I should go to Alaska next.
Do you think some people make the comparison, Mark, with 1938 and Czechoslovakia, which is, you know, you continue to try and appease... Yeah, trying to appease someone, and then they come back, and they're there. It's like salami slicing, right? They want a little bit, and they want a little bit more, and they want a little bit more, and then before you know where they are, you've given away the entire thing. Do you think that is where we are right now?
Yes. You cannot appease somebody...
So Trump is Chamberlain. Trump is Chamberlain, in your view.
Yeah. In fact, I think he's weaker than Chamberlain, because he sees starry-eyed, hearty-eyed in the likes of Putin.
Mark, in Tamworth, grateful to you. I want to continue this conversation, in particular, about this question that the White House is putting out about land swaps. Land swaps for Ukraine. The idea that basically Ukraine would cede territory to the Russians in exchange for peace. Can that possibly ever be right? Are we, as that and Mark was just saying there, is that just appeasement, the Sudetenland, 1938 all over again? Isn't the truth that Ukraine has been doing us all a favor, a massive favor, for the last 3.5 years? They have been fighting the biggest threat to European security since the end of the Second World War, certainly since the end and fall of the USSR. With Ukraine out of the picture, who's going to be next?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, Volodymyr Zelensky is in Washington ahead of critical talks with President Trump about ending the war in Ukraine. Mr. Trump has already ruled out the return of occupied Crimea and NATO membership for Ukraine as part of any truce. Mr. Zelensky has said he wants to end the conflict with Russia quickly and reliably. NATO's former head of policy planning, Fabrice Pothier, has told Lewis European leaders will have to walk a tightrope with Donald Trump later on.
A bully never wants to feel cornered. And President Trump essentially is a geopolitical bully. So I think this is really about that thin line. And to help Zelensky in framing the conversation into not Ukraine making concessions, but about Ukraine having the assets it needs to come to a proper peace that is just and that is sustainable.
Politicians across Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales have urged Sir Keir Starmer to act now to pressure Israel to end the war in Gaza. In a letter led by the nationalist SDLP party, they say Parliament should be recalled and arms sales to Israel suspended. It says thousands of people gathered in Tel Aviv yesterday to demonstrate against the conflict. Freelance journalist Nogaton Opolsky, who's based in Jerusalem, has told LBC that unrest is growing in Israel.
It was a wide-ranging Stop the War rally that was actually spearheaded by family members of people murdered on October 7th, 2023. But they were quickly joined by hostages' families and hundreds of thousands of sympathizers and, I think, general issue Israelis who are fed up with the situation.
Israel's prime minister has criticized the protests, saying they will only harden Hamas's stance. Sir Keir Starmer has said the UK will recognise a Palestinian state by September unless Israel takes steps to end the conflict in Gaza. A man arrested after the Bournemouth footballer Antoine Semenyo, reported being racially abused, has been released on bail. The forward reported alleged comments made during his side's defeat to Liverpool at Anfield in their Premier League game on Friday. A new report says British manufacturing is lagging behind global leaders in AI by around 2 decades because of poor support and training. The manufacturing group Make UK says more investment is needed in digital skills, but the government says it is taking action to remove barriers to growth. And ministers are promising more patients in England will be able to get checks and scans out of hours. 100 community diagnostic centres are now staying open for longer as part of plans to improve access to healthcare. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 6 points at 91.32. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, widespread sunshine will develop after a cloudy end to the morning. Thundery downpours in the southwest, highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
There now follows a message from the Prime Minister.
Some of you may know, my husband is being held hostage. They are targeting me. They have weaponized my family. I will not be threatened. My loyalties are to this country. I will not allow it to be held to ransom. And anyone who thinks that I would has badly underestimated me.
Hostage, starring Saran Jones, coming soon only on Netflix.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 11:04. A reminder of the gravity of events that face us today. President Zelensky is calling for a lasting peace, emphasis on the lasting, to end the war, and warned that Putin had previously seized Ukrainian land as a springboard for a new attack. He made the comments on Twitter X after he arrived in Washington this morning for high-stakes meetings at the White House. On Monday, just hours after his arrival, a Russian drone attack on a multi-story residential building in the northeastern Ukrainian city of Kharkiv killed six people, including a child. Video of the aftermath of the strike released by the local authorities there showed parts of the building's roof and upper floors have been completely gutted as firefighters on a ladder spray water to try and extinguish the flames. Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's chief of staff, had his own post on X saying that's why Putin doesn't want to cease fire. He enjoys the peaceful shelling, the shelling of peaceful cities, while talking about his desire to end the war. A reminder, of course, that Putin could end this war tomorrow at no threat to his own country. None at all. We talk about this war sometimes as if it's inexorable, as if there's a law of physics to the entire thing, that something in opposition to it needs to come down externally to stop the fighting. It doesn't. It could all happen from within. Trump had said last night that Zelensky could choose to end this war only by the acceptance of the butchering of his own country. And worse than that, maybe in some world, Zelensky could get to a place where you could imagine something a bit like what happened in Finland in the Winter War in the 1940s, where, yes, they give up land to the then Soviet Union in exchange for a long-term peace. But, of course, the difference is that there can be no obvious guarantee that Putin wouldn't come back for more later. Because if Zelensky were to give in to the maximal demands of Putin, which is to cede all of the Donbass, not just the bits, the two-thirds that he controls at the moment, but the remaining third, he would be giving up his equivalent of the Maginot Line in the First World War, the most fortified bit of land that Ukraine currently has, full of trenches, full of mines, full of anti-tank weaponry, and it would be simply ceded, which then could be used as a point of departure for another war in 12 months or 18 months or 36 months or whatever it happens to be. These are invidious, difficult decisions for Zelensky. No one wants this war to continue. But if it doesn't continue, I go back to what Boris Johnson said in 2022. Will Russia not only have failed, but not be seen to fail? It seems to me right now that the best outcome could be at least that Putin and Russia are not seen to have succeeded, at least not if completely failed. That's a subtle distinction, but a distinction that I think is the only thing at the moment that the West can fight for. Because if it is seen to have succeeded, which would be the maximalist objectives that Putin has, which would be the complete ceding of the Donbass, which would be Ukraine never being allowed to join NATO or Ukraine, which would probably also include the removal of Zelensky himself, and then Putin able to bombard the country in whatever fragile peace continues to exist and which endures, with continued election interference, with more dirty tactics, with false flag operations, you name it, destabilizing the political integrity of Ukraine, whilst all the time moving the army machine that he's built to other parts of Eastern Europe, intimidating NATO, intimidating the West. That is the worst outcome possible. Because you know what Europe's dirty little secret is? The truth is that Ukraine has been doing us all a massive favor this last 3.5 years, because it has been keeping the Russian war machine bogged down within its own borders, succeeding when no one thought they could. Yeah, we've been giving them weapons. Yeah, we've been giving them support. But they've been doing our dirty work, because we know that Putin's territorial ambitions are not limited to Ukraine. It goes back to how I started the show. It is about, in his view, a restoration, a correction to history, to Russian pride, to imperial ambition, to being a great power. Nothing frustrated Putin more when Obama, perhaps unwisely, in 2014 described Russia as being a regional power rather than a global one. It's humiliation for Putin, someone who is obsessed with history, who believes that history is at his back, who believes in the great man vision of history, that one man, whether it's Joseph Stalin or Peter the Great or whoever it happens to be, is the man who course corrects, around whom history is shaped. That is the sort of person that Putin believes he is. So in his own weird way does Donald Trump. And that is what thrilled Putin so much about that Alaska summit, because it allowed him to do what he's long wanted to do, which is present Russia as one of the great powers, carving up the world as he sees fit. Can the surrender of Ukrainian land be justified? And if it is justified, what can we do to make sure that this never, ever happens again? Or can we? 0345-6060973. 0345-6060973. You can text as well, 84850. Let's turn now to Lee Turner, former British ambassador to Ukraine, author of Lessons in Diplomacy, Politics, Power and Parties. Lee, thanks so much for joining us this morning. What do you think will be going through the heads of those European leaders in the Oval Office today and Zelensky himself? What do you think their objectives will be for the end of the day?
Hi, Lewis. Good to speak to you. Yes, I liked your summary of the war so far, by the way. The one only thing you missed out was the fact that Putin's main priority in all this is to stay in power himself and to prevent democracy in Ukraine from sweeping into Russia. But let's leave that aside for a moment. Yes, I think this is really an important day for the future of Ukraine. We have this catastrophic summit in Anchorage, in Alaska, as you summarized just now, Putin turning up with extreme demands and then making them even more extreme. And then President Trump, for reasons which aren't clear, simply swallowing the lot, including giving up the rest of the Donetsk Oblast that Russia hasn't been able to conquer in 9 years of fighting. That's an area, by the way, that's not yet been conquered, about five times the size of Greater London, so quite a big area. This wasn't negotiation. This was rolling over. And now the one piece of good news that we have is that the Europeans, including Sir Keir Starmer, are arriving in force in Washington to back up President Zelensky in his talks with President Trump today. Now, why are they doing it? For all the reasons you've been talking about, the principle that you can't change borders by force is fundamental to all of our security. And it's baffling that Trump doesn't see that, that if we are to live in a new world where Russia has won this war and is ready to attack Ukraine again, but might also attack Kazakhstan or Moldova or the Baltic states, or other countries are encouraged to think they can invade their neighbours and steal their land, we're going to be in a whole new dangerous world, which will require massive more defence spending. We'll have a world where every country wants to acquire nuclear weapons, because otherwise they can be invaded by their nuclear-armed neighbour, as Russia has invaded Ukraine. So that is their top priority for the Europeans arriving in Washington today, to emphasize this principle that international borders can't be changed by force. As the Estonian foreign minister said the other day, if borders can be changed by force, none of us are safe.
Some have cited a couple of previous conflicts that might provide a model for this war. The Winter War might be one, the war between the USSR and Finland, which did involve Finland giving up about 11% of its land in exchange for peace. And there are some comparisons there, because, again, in the 40s, no one thought the Finns would be able to fight off the USSR. They did, eventually with the loss of that land. Or, indeed, the Korean War, where everybody sort of accepts a de facto border, even though where one de jure doesn't really exist. Do you think that those models can provide an end, or at least a cessation, to this conflict? And if they were to do so, what would have to happen to make sure that Russia didn't come back for a second bite of the cherry?
It's a really important distinction to be made here between recognizing de jure that any square inch of Ukraine is under Russian sovereignty, which would set a disastrous precedent for our security across the world, and recognizing that they are de facto under control of Russia. That is to say, Russia is physically in charge of them, but we don't recognize Russian sovereignty over that land. And that's a really good precedent, and that is what happened, for example, with the Baltic states, which were invaded first by Nazi Germany and then by the Soviet Union. And for 50 years, the UK and the US did not recognize the Baltic states as part of the Soviet Union. And then eventually in 1990, they regained their independence. So if it were a question of saying, well, we accept that this land is occupied by Russia for the time being, that might well be a way forward towards reaching a peace agreement. But if the US or any other serious country were to recognize Russian sovereignty over any part of Ukraine, that would be another kettle of fish altogether and much more dangerous for all of us.
Isn't it truly that what Putin did in Alaska was to present a list of demands for Trump that he was completely aware? He knew that Zelensky couldn't accept, that European countries couldn't accept. And therefore, all it was really about was the management, which is basically what Ukraine and Russia have been doing for the last 3 or 4 months, the management of Donald Trump's perceptions, i.e. who is the block, the impediment to the resolution of the war and potentially to my Nobel Peace Prize. And Putin was, again, I mean, maybe Zelensky will be successful in kind of handing the baton back, but he was successful in basically convincing Trump once again that it wasn't him.
It is extraordinary, isn't it, that President Trump consistently is so pro-Russian that he blames Ukraine for this war starting, that he voted, he had the US vote alongside Russia and North Korea and Belarus and such countries in February against a resolution condemning Russian aggression. And now we see him apparently siding with Ukraine, with Russia yet again. One of the very interesting questions that we may see addressed today is this rabbit that Steve Witkoff, Trump's all-purpose envoy, pulled out of the hat yesterday when he suddenly said that the Russians had agreed to the US providing what he called Article 5-like protection for a peace deal in Ukraine. Now, of course, you can't have Article 5 protection unless you're a member of NATO, which Russia seems unlikely to accept. And this idea of the US providing security guarantees to Ukraine is potentially very important, but we need to tease out exactly what it means, because up to now, President Trump has been saying ensuring any future deal is nothing to do with the US. It's up to the Europeans to do this. So, firstly, the idea that Trump would actually offer to guarantee a peace deal, and secondly, the idea that the Russians allegedly have agreed to this, the Russians haven't actually commented since Witkoff said that yesterday, is extremely important. And I think the Europeans will be wanting to hear more about that.
What role, I mean, Starmer's going today. We initially briefed over the course of the weekend he wouldn't be going, but clearly there was a change of decision that they decided to all go en masse. Extraordinary meeting. These things normally, you know, plan for months, if not years in advance. This is all happening on the hoof, sort of de facto kind of impromptu summit. What role do you think Starmer can and should play in this? He has managed to, perhaps against the odds, strike up some sort of personal relationship with Trump. Trump hasn't, despite what many predicted, chosen to sort of attack him or to mock him or anything like that. There's clearly some relationship there, perhaps better than most European leaders. What role, if any, do you think Britain can and should play in all this?
I think it's great that Keir Starmer is going to Washington today alongside other European leaders. It's interesting to analyse the team that they are sending there. Nearly all of them are people who have a record of getting on well with Donald Trump. We've got Merz of Germany, Macron of France, Starmer from the UK. They're like the big three, if you like. Plus, we have Giorgia Meloni of Italy, who's got on well with Trump in the past, a guy called Alexander Stubb, the Prime Minister of Finland, again, quite a renowned Trump whisperer, and then Mark Rutte of NATO, who has been roundly criticised for smarming up to Trump too much.
Daddy, calling him daddy.
Daddy, yeah, daddy. But as we saw in Anchorage, you can't smarm up to Trump too much. We saw President Putin, a master Trump whisperer, actually saying, delivering a Trump line, which was that if Trump had been in power when Russia first invaded Ukraine, the war would never have happened. So I think that they will be trying to reel Trump back in from presenting maximalist Russian positions as a US position and of blaming Ukraine if they don't agree to a completely unacceptable peace settlement. So they will be exploring those two things. First of all, what happens to borders and land? And secondly, very important, what to make of these apparent US proposals for guaranteeing a future peace deal and whether Russia has really agreed to those.
Lee Turner there, former British ambassador to Ukraine, author, as I say, of Lessons in Diplomacy, Politics, Power and Parties. Can it ever be acceptable to trade land for peace in the modern world in the 21st century? Down the barrel of a gun, which is basically what's happened. Had we not left that world behind? And do you agree with Lee that if we do that, and that is recognised, that that is setting a very dangerous precedent for the future? 0345 6060973, 0345 6060973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien all this week here on LBC. The time is 11:19.
This is LBC.
Ratimi likes Pension B's modern approach to pensions.
I think Pension B has brought pensions into the 21st century, firstly through the use of technology. Signing up to the app is super simple. Pension B makes me feel very confident about my finances and makes me feel like I have a plan when it comes to my retirement.
At Pension B, we believe that when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. Download the app or go to pensionb.com and be pension confident. When investing, your capital is at risk.
At TfL, we're making tube journeys faster in the future with signalling improvements underway on the Circle, District, Hammersmith and City and Metropolitan lines. And there's also the Elizabeth line, already giving you fast journeys across central London. That is how we're making the greener way to travel brighter for everyone. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Elizabeth Line is fast compared to other TfL modes. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Buying a home on a holiday park was a dream that became a nightmare. High-pressure sales tactics, huge site fee increases, and a loss of value have left many customers feeling misled, angry, and trapped. But the Holiday Park Advice Centre can help. Contact us today and we'll help claim back any money you're owed on your holiday home. Text ASSIST to 78900 to get started.
Hello, Holiday Park Advice Centre.
That's ASSIST to 78900.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Of your texts here, Andy in Portsmouth says, "Morning, Lewis. I'm furious that European leaders are visiting the White House." White Horse, he says here. White Horse, quite nice. "With Zelensky. I believe they think they can intimidate Trump into refusing to make a peace deal. I believe they want the war to continue where Trump wants the killing to stop, even if it means giving up land." And yeah, I don't think no one wants the war to continue. These European leaders didn't want the war to happen. The only person in the world who wants the war to continue is Vladimir Putin. A load of Russians don't want it to continue. Because how many Russian mothers have ended up crying and weeping at their sons' gravesides over the last 3.5 years for a war that was completely and utterly pointless and futile and stupid and predicated on absurd, noxious reasoning? So many. So the idea that it's European leaders' fault, what the European leaders are worried about is that if Putin is seen to have won the war and that there is now this precedent that you can basically just take land wherever you want to do it just because might is right, that's what they're trying to prevent. So that's just a stupid comment. Samuel says, "Why do you think that Trump wants to end the war? Don't think if he wants to, it's because he cares about lives, the people, the security of Europe." Samuel, I think he's genuinely been disturbed by what he sees. He watches loads of cable news and he sees the pictures and he doesn't like it. He doesn't understand the point of it. He's right not to. I also think he wants the Nobel Peace Prize and maybe some Russian oil contracts as well for his country. And Gregory says, "Goodall, your interview with Vasilov tells us about the historic binary analysis of a complex and long-running problem of ethnicity and nationalism." Well, Gregory, I don't know if you mean that as a compliment or not, but I'm just going to take it as a compliment anyway, because you know what? It's Monday. Let's want to go to more of your calls on Ukraine in a second. But we should just have a look at the question as well of what's going on in Israel. And the fact that we haven't got that guest yet. So let's go to Theo, who's in Crouch End. Theo.
Hello, how are you?
Hi, well, thank you. You got something to say about Ukraine?
Yes, well, I'm a freelance journalist. I run a Substack called Dictators v. Democrats, where I talk about the threats to democracy around the world. I've been to Ukraine a number of times. And I've been to Donbass as well. And ceding that land will, as has been said, bypass enormous defensive lines that have been built, bypass the river, that huge natural barrier that runs through the country, and act as a springboard. And Putin's maximalist goals are not Donetsk, Luhansk. They are the whole country.
Yeah.
As was set out, and I was at the presser with President Zelensky at the start of the year, as was set out and as repeated by the head of GUR, 3 days to take Kyiv, 10 days to pacify the rest of the country. That was the goal. Yep. And in reality, it remains so. Now, the timeline has obviously been moved because they weren't met with bread and salt, as the propaganda stated that they would be. They were met with javelins instead. But those goals remain the same because, as you've said, Putin subscribes to great man theory of history,
yep.
And he needs Russia to be an empire again. And Russia can never be an empire in his eyes without the full control of Ukraine,
yep.
And turning it into a state, something along the lines of Belarus, or even eventually subsuming it completely. And if we allow that, then we return to the 19th century. We return to wars being fought over provinces here and there. We return to imperialism. And we return to a much darker and less secure age.
Well, it's that quote from Brzezinski, isn't it? He was a U.S. Secretary of State succeeding Henry Kissinger. And he said, without Ukraine, Russia ceases to be an empire. But with Ukraine, suborned and then subordinated, Russia automatically becomes an empire. He was saying that in the 1970s, but it's completely true in the 2020s.
Yeah, it remains. I mean, Russia is still, in the way it's set up, an empire today. It acts incredibly imperialist around its around the regions, you know, Nenets, Buryat, Ichkerians. They're the ones doing a lot of the dying, not people from Moscow or Petersburg. And we also ought to recognize that. And if any land, I don't think any land should be traded, but if the front lines are frozen, which is a question whether or not the Ukrainians will accept it, I think a Korea situation is probably the most likely.
Well, it seems to me, Theo, that, look, I mean, the truth is that for those of us who are emotionally, politically sympathetic to Ukraine and see the wider dangers, and exactly as you very articulately expressed, the dangers of being seen to reward 19th century type land grabs and what that means for the future of European security. That's all true, and that sentiment is very deeply felt within us. We also, there is an element of realpolitik that I do understand when people say, well, do you want the war to keep going? All of this death, all of this destruction, and frankly, Ukraine isn't winning the war at the moment. I get all of that, and so I can totally see the advantages, even though it is grim to accept, in some sort of deal which freezes, accepts is de facto, not de jure, freezes the front line where it is. But if we do that, and that's the Trump peace plan, then the point is what comes next? Because if we do that, what we have to accept is we need to arm Ukraine to the absolute teeth to make sure that there is a proper deterrent, that Russia does not come back again. Because if we just stop the fighting and then go, oh, okay, well, that's it. You know, our obligations to Ukraine are discharged.
Yeah.
Then that is just setting ourselves up, Ukraine up, but also setting out all of us up for a bigger conflagration down the line.
And the best deterrent will and really has to be soldiers with British, French, German flags 15 kilometres behind the DMZ in Ukraine.
Yeah, something to think about, isn't it? Theo in Crouch End, grateful to you. Phil is in Oxford, who has something to say about this. Phil, good morning.
Good morning, Lewis. It's good to speak to you. I admire your work.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
You're welcome. That's the most uplifting thing I can say.
Oh, well, let's just leave it there, shall we?
Yeah, let's leave it there. Give a cheerio. I'm scared, and I think I'm rationally scared, I believe, with what's going on. Absolutely agree with Theo and the points you've made that if we placate Putin in any way, it will just embolden him for the near future. But also, the near future is actually kind of with us now. If we look at the great untalked about topic of the Gulf of Finland, I've got family in Helsinki, and the Finns are very, very worried, quite rightly, about the least reported fact that Russia are seeking to rewrite and reappraise the maritime international boundaries within the Gulf of Finland. They're only doing, and that's not saber rattling. That, you know, with all the difficulties that are going on there, they are already being expansionist in that direction as well as Ukraine. Ask the Estonians, ask the Latvians, do they think it's a real existential threat that Russia are going to start rolling
well,
in?
It's yes, no, they do. It's no surprise. You're absolutely right about Finland, Phil. I mean, it's no surprise that earlier this year, the Finns said that they expect Russia to further build up troops along their border when the Ukraine war ends. And the head of their military, the head of the Finnish Defence Forces, said that their Finnish army has been following Russia, Moscow's manoeuvring very closely, and they think that NATO needs to prepare for the worst. And no one knows. I mean, Finland's got a very, very long history of dealing with Russian expansionism, so no one knows that theatre better than they.
Precisely. You know, talk to the experts, and that's how they are. And I'm afraid, you know, and I hope that the European cohort will manage to persuade Trump away from this romance almost that he seems to have with Putin. And I'm not a fan of Boris Johnson at all, but I thought the article I heard he wrote in, I suppose it was the Telegraph, about how nauseous and chunder-making, I think he said. He found a whole episode between in Alaska. But yeah, underpinning that, he's saying, but Trump's right. He's got, and I like the Churchill George or not war, but the jaw bit cannot actually spout out something that is entirely suiting Putin's needs and ambitions.
Maybe it's time we've got to get serious, Phil. Maybe it's time for this continent to finally get serious about its defence. And maybe it's time we start thinking about, if we're thinking about serious deterrent, maybe we need a European army. Maybe we need an actual shared defence project that maybe is beyond NATO, beyond the European Union, but something that actually would give Putin something to think about, given we can't rely on the Americans in the way that we once did.
Because this is overlaid by Trump's, shall we say, ambivalence about the future contributions to NATO.
Indeed,
so I'm scared, and I wish I wasn't, but I am. I'm scared for me, my kids, my grandkids, anybody's kids.
I don't think it's irrational. I don't think that's irrational, Phil, as much as I hate to say it. I think we are a bit of a perilous moment. Phil in Oxford, grateful to you. They're just on the Finnish stuff, by the way. If anyone doubts Russian expansionism, just do some reading. Just do some reading. Look at what's happened in Finland. The Finnish government sharing satellite images published in the New York Times showing expansion, this is earlier a few months ago, showing an expansion of military infrastructure near the Finnish border, including rows of tents, military vehicles, renovations to fighter jet shelters, construction on previously unused helicopter bases. The head of the Finnish army saying they are changing their structures. We're seeing preparations when it comes to building infrastructure close to our borders, meaning that they will, once the war in Ukraine hopefully ends, start to bring back the forces that have been fighting in Ukraine. NATO, of course, Finland, of course, joined NATO in 2023. Russia wouldn't have liked that. But guess what? If you have a country which is invading its neighbours, its other neighbours are going to start taking precautions because they think we're going to be next. That is completely reasonable. The problem here, people often go on about NATO expansionism to the east. After the end of the Cold War, European defence spending, NATO defence spending plummeted. If it was all about NATO expansionism and we were planning some incursion into Russia, why would we have been slashing our armies and our navies and our armed forces? We wouldn't. We weren't. NATO is a defensive alliance, and it is a fig leaf of Russian propaganda to put out there that somehow this was all about NATO expansionism. It's all the West's fault. The West has done some awful things. It's often hypocritical. It's often a joke. Some of the way that we talk about our values and then don't live up to them. But the idea in this case that this is the West's fault, it's for the birds. It is just Kremlin talking points. After the news, I'll be joined by one of the mothers at last night's protest in Tel Aviv. As pressure continues to mount on the Netanyahu government, all that and more to come for the latest. LBC News headlines now at 11:33 with Dominic Ellis.
Donald Trump says the return of Crimea and membership of NATO won't be offered to Ukraine in any US-brokered peace deal. Posting on social media ahead of his meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky later, the US president said it's up to Ukraine's leader to make a deal with Russia. Senior politicians in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza. They've written a letter to Keir Starmer calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. And a man arrested after the Bournemouth footballer Antoine Semenyo reported being racially abused has been released on bail. The forward reported alleged comments made during his side's 4-2 defeat to Liverpool in their Premier League game on Friday. LBC weather. Widespread sunshine will develop later after a cloudy morning. The risk of a few heavy showers in the southwest. Highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
The best bit of sailing from Dover to Calais has to be the Irish Ferries bit. Irish Ferries. See travel differently.
In a world where innovation meets style, there's a new name on the road. And right now, families like yours are discovering a car brand that values you. Feel the future in motion as the Emotify petrol and E5 electric blend next level technology with real family life. With state-of-the-art features and advanced safety systems as standard, say hello to a car that fits your lifestyle and your future. Starting from £23,990. Book your test drive online now or visit FG Barnes Emoda Guildford today. Emoda. Value everything.
The road stretches before you, but there's trouble ahead. Stationary cars. You're faced with a McDonald's side mission. Do you, A, join the ever-growing queue, or B, take the next exit and treat yourself to a glorious Mackey's?
Detouring to McDonald's.
Start your side mission today.
If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, what you thought you were getting may not be what you ended up with. From unexpected site fee increases, running costs, a huge depreciation in value, many owners feel they've been missold. If you think this might be you, holidayparkadvicecentre.co.uk could help you receive the compensation you're entitled to. Text ASSIST to 78900 to find out more. That's ASSIST to 78900.
The advert looked genuine. A post from a household name, experts in money, a hot opportunity. They asked for a small amount, promised a great return, took all I had, and then disappeared. Investment scammers are highly sophisticated, and every month CEL talk to thousands of people like you who've fallen victim. Our experts can help recover your money. So head to celsolicitors.co.uk today.
CEL. This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is 11:36. We're going to get an update in a moment from one of the hostage families with regards to what we saw, the extraordinary protests that we saw in Tel Aviv yesterday, and the even more extraordinary Israeli government reaction to those protests. But President Zelensky has actually just tweeted in the last couple of minutes about that strike which killed six people, Russian strike in Kharkiv yesterday. That is, of course, on the eve of this crucial summit with Zelensky going to Washington. Zelensky saying this was a demonstrative and cynical Russian strike. They are aware, that is the Russians, are aware that a meeting is taking place in Washington that will address the end of the war. He says they'll have discussions with President Trump about key issues along with European leaders. He said everyone seeks dignified peace and true security. And yet at this very moment, the Russians are attacking Kharkiv, Zaporizhia, the Sumy region and Odessa, destroying residential buildings and our civilian infrastructure. Russians are deliberately killing people, particularly children. As of now, seven people have been killed as a result of the drone strike in Kharkiv, the youngest being a girl who is only a year and a half old. That is, as he says, alongside dozens being injured, including children. Then alongside that, he cites that in Zaporizhia, missile strikes have injured 20 and killed 3. Also saying there was a deliberate Russian strike on an energy facility in Odessa. This is where we are. And all of the Russian propagandists messaging in like they always do saying that somehow this is Ukraine's fault and that Ukraine's at fault here. Unfortunately, a talking point which has been swallowed by the President of the United States on occasion. He sort of veers quixotically between the two meanders around it, but nonetheless, sometimes. This is what we're dealing with here. None of this has to happen. None of this has to happen. Putin could end the war today. He didn't need to start it 3.5 years ago. He was in a powerful position to demand concessions, whatever security concerns he had. He did not need to do this. He does not need to do this. This war continues because the Kremlin chooses to make it continue. We'll return to that and your calls on all of that shortly. Let's get an update now on what's been going on in Israel. And I think you can draw some parallels between those things, which I can talk about a little bit in a second. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed this morning that the nationwide strikes in support of the hostages in Hamas captivity on Sunday are delaying their release and preventing the war from coming to an end. So it isn't the Israeli government that's at fault there and not getting the hostages out. He's saying that it's the hostage families effectively and those who are protesting with them. Netanyahu's statements came at the government security cabinet meeting that took place amid the strikes. They also echoed the various criticisms from coalition members of parliament who have slammed the protest, with many claiming the demonstrations are aiding the Hamas terror group by dividing the country. Netanyahu claimed the protests were hardening Hamas's position and delaying the release of our hostages, adding that the strikes were also ensuring that the horrors of October the 7th will repeat themselves and we'll have to fight a war without end. The October Council, a forum of hostages' families and bereaved families, announced a nationwide strike a week earlier in protest of the Security Cabinet's decision to occupy Gaza City, which they said would endanger the lives of hostages and soldiers. So here we have Benjamin Netanyahu trotting out the line, which he does repeatedly, about foreign governments, including our own, led by Keir Starmer, saying that whenever they criticise Israel, that is somehow emboldening or strengthening or empowering Hamas. He's now saying that of those who are supporting the hostages, his own citizens, and by extension, really, the hostage families themselves. Well, let's talk now to the mother of one of those hostages, Idit Ohel, mother of Alon Ohel. She's calling for a referendum on the future of the war. Alon, thanks so much for joining us this morning. What do you make of how the Israeli government has responded to these protests?
I don't even know how to answer it because I don't understand it. They knew there were going to be a protest. If they thought really that this protest will be dangerous or in some kind of way prolong the release of the hostages, they probably would have said something, you know, when some things that we've been doing that are dangerous or doing bad for something, that usually they say. So I don't know about that. But I do know that, you know, my son is being tortured every day. He's being starved. He is injured and he needs to come home. So what am I supposed to do if not ask and demand that that the war will stop so my son can come home and will be released from being a captive, you know? He was kidnapped from Israeli land, an innocent civilian, and he needs to come home. So as a mother, I have to do everything. And if there's so many people, there's 80% of the population in Israel want the war to be ended and the hostages to return. We know this. And yesterday was just another way of saying, hey, this is what the citizens want.
When you hear Israeli ministers saying that the protesters and indeed the families in calling for a change or in arguing that somehow that a deal would endanger Israeli security, how does it feel when you hear ministers suggest that you are strengthening Hamas, which is of course the terrible organization which has caused so much heartache and destruction and death and has traumatized your family and your son?
I guess it's his way of seeing things. It's not my way. I don't see that. You know, this war started on the 7th of October, 2023. I don't see anybody taking responsibility for it. Not our government anyway, not anybody taking responsible for what had happened. I'm seeing my son and I'm saying, okay, you know, I need to do everything I can This is part of it. Demanding, not just from Israel, I think it's demanding from the world to say, hey, this is not okay. This is not okay to starve people. I'm talking about my son. I don't think there's really starvation in Gaza from the Gazans. I think it's just, it's not real, but it is real starving hostages. And it is real not getting any of the hostages any medical attention. I think there's Hamas is doing terrible things to their own, you know, to their own people. And we have to stop this. The world cannot continue in saying all this.
Do you think your government cares about what happens to your son?
I hope so. I hope they do. I think they're just, they have a different way of showing it or doing things that they think is right in their eyes. I think my government does want the hostages to be returned. They're doing it in their way. But it's not enough for me because my son is still there. The war should be over. I have to think how we're going to get it over and bring all the hostages home.
Tell us about your son. Tell us about the last time you saw him. Tell us about, do you know anything about his current whereabouts or welfare? Tell us about him.
So Alon was like a month before he was kidnapped, came back from traveling all over Asia. And he came back and went to the Nova Festival. Alon is a musician. He's a pianist, and he loves music. So obviously he went to this peace festival. And he was kidnapped from a bomb shelter where he was trying to get cover from all the rockets. And he was kidnapped, not just him, just three others with him. Hirsch Goldberg Pullin and Elia Cohen and Or Levy were kidnapped with him. Sadly, Hirsch was murdered in captivity. And Alon is still there. Alon now, some of the hostages that were with him the whole time came back 5 months ago. And he was left alone. We know that he was chained in his legs, starved. He was injured when he was in the bomb shelter. When the grenades were thrown into the bomb shelter, he was injured. He has sharp nails all over his body and one in his eye, so he can't see in one eye. And we are worried about his conditions because the ICRC, the Red Cross, has never seen any of the hostages. Alan has never got any medical attention. We do know that a 19-year-old took a needle and thread and sewed his skin, leaving all the sharp nails in his body. We do know that that he's alive, but we don't know anything else about now what's going on.
But we do know, of course, as well. I mean, what has happened to your son and the family and the hostages in general, those who've been killed, those who've been kept for so long, unimaginable heartbreak, unimaginable pain. There is, of course, also a great deal of pain going on in Gaza. People are malnourished. People have starved. Do you believe that anything can justify that?
There's food. There's a lot of food in Gaza. I think it doesn't get to the people because the Hamas don't let the food get into the people.
To be fair, most international organizations would say that is not the case, that there is starvation in Gaza.
Well, I don't know. I have not been able to get in Gaza because if I could go to Gaza, I would bring my son home.
Indeed.
I don't know about that. I don't know. I'm just Alon's mother, but I do know. Okay. But what I've been told and what I've been seen is that there is food, but it doesn't get to where it's supposed to get because the Hamas doesn't let the food get to Gaza. There's a lot of food in Gaza. Hamas has a lot of food. We know about the hostages that the Hamas eats, doesn't give them food, obviously, but they're eating very, very nice. It doesn't matter. The point is, it's heartbreaking what's going on in Gaza.
Of course.
Heartbreaking to both. And we just need this to be end. So we can continue with our lives.
Okay.
And that is the point. The point is that we need to finish all of this and we need to get it done. And we need we need the world to help, I guess, with this.
Okay. Idiot O'Hell, mother of Alon O'Hell, who has been kidnapped all this time. Grateful to her. And you can obviously hear the pain in her voice. I think everybody would deeply sympathise with that. And she and other hostage families believing that, and have long believed, that the Israeli government is not doing anything adequately enough to secure the release of their families. Just as a point of information, this is something that is contested within Israel, as you just heard, but as a point of objective fact, if we're to take what the UN-backed Global Food Security program has warned, and this is as recently as the 29th of July, the worst-case scenario of famine is currently playing out in the Gaza Strip. They say that there are rising hunger-related deaths. The latest data indicates that famine threshold have been reached for food consumption in most of the Gaza Strip and for acute malnutrition in Gaza City, saying in July there were at least 63 malnutrition-related deaths that month alone. The facts are, and they are undeniable, they say, this is UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres, Palestinians in Gaza are enduring a humanitarian catastrophe of epic proportions. That does not, of course, take away the plight and the horror of the families and the hostages, but those are the facts. There we are. The time is 11:49.
This is LBC.
Body pain might not sound like this.
Oh.
Or this.
Oh.
But it might sound like this.
I'm fine.
Hiding your body pain behind a smile? Let us help. With up to 12 hours of uninterrupted muscle and joint pain relief. Voltarol, the joy of movement. Voltarol Joint and Back Pain Relief 2.3% gel contains diclofenac diethylammonium. Always read the label.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
4. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV. Plus, change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
Managing your business is a big task. To then stay on top of the numbers as well? You're only human. That's why the Intuit QuickBooks AI-powered platform supports your business growth as the number one recommended cloud accounting software. Intuit QuickBooks. Based on a survey of 506 UK accounting professionals. Verify at quickbooks.co.uk/verify.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See Lidl.co.uk/LPTV. Offer ends 27th of August.
Train to Worthing for scuba training. Yep. We're that family now.
Josh, flip us off until you're in the water, mate.
Well, I look ridiculous, but they're loving it.
Maddie, goggles the other way around, sweetie.
Ah, seats found, kids happy. Heading home. Definitely bringing these wetsuits to our next beach day.
Download the Southern Railway app to book kids' tickets for £2 on off-peak journeys. Southern Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
Would anyone like some Bourneville dark chocolate?
Is it so dark the aftertaste lasts for a week?
No.
Does it taste really, really complicated?
What? Is it saturated in nibs?
So dark it comes with a therapist?
To the uneducated palate, does it taste like burnt tyre?
Would scientists compare the taste to dark matter?
Is it artisanal, in all caps?
Are the tasting notes gloom?
No, no pretentiousness, no complexity, no bitterness. Just smooth dark chocolate from Cadbury. Cadbury Bourneville, made to be enjoyed, not endured.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Text 84850.
Time is 11:51. We're going to have a story coming up about Grant Shapps. And if that doesn't keep the radio on, then I don't know what will. Cormac is in Kennington. Cormac, got something to say about Ukraine, not Grant Shapps.
Lewis, thanks very much for having me on. Can I say today of all days, when we need to get a bit of clarity around the truth, thank you for the way you're conducting this conversation on Ukraine. And of course, there's no one better you could have on than the great Lee Turner, a former colleague of mine, actually a former ambassador to Ukraine.
Brilliant. Absolutely
look,
brilliant.
Yeah, yes, he is. I have huge respect for Lee. Look, I was seething with rage earlier, you know, when the Russian commentator on and then when the caller came on from Budapest.
Yes.
I'll tell you what I wanted to say. 3.5 years ago, just after this invasion, I sat down with one of my best Ukrainian friends, a man called Alexei Mikheyev. He's currently the ambassador to Berlin for Ukraine. Right. And we said, Let us identify the five biggest lies which Russia tells and use for idiots amplify. And if I can give them to you quickly and to the listeners, I'd really urge people to bear these in mind. One, it was all NATO's fault. It was about NATO expansion. It wasn't. There was never a binding undertaking given. You know, Finland, you talked about, has a border of 1,340 kilometres with Russia. When they first joined NATO 2 years ago, Russia started to pull back from their border. Donbass was never a civil war. This is the Russian narrative that they had to go into and help the Russian separatists. It was always a war that was fomented by Russia. There was also the lie that, you know, Maidan was a US-backed coup. That was the Maidan Revolution of Dignity in 2013-14. It wasn't. And of course, there was genocide of genocide and victimization of the Russian-speaking minority. You mentioned Mariupol. I have a friend who fought in the defense of Mariupol, was captured and tortured for 2 years before getting out, and a former British soldier, Sean Pinner.
I've interviewed women from Mariupol whose husbands and sons were all killed in the obliteration of it. There's nothing left of their home. So when these talking points that come up that somehow none of this exists, it's not just post-truth. It's horrific.
Look, I mean, remember, Mariupol is a city the size of Edinburgh, 500,000 people. It has been wiped off the map. The most conservative estimate is 25,000 civilians murdered. Estimates go to over 100,000, with 95% of the buildings wiped out. And that was a Russian-speaking city where the politics before the further invasion was very, very Russian-friendly.
Yes, this is the irony which I've been pointing out to people all morning, which is that the region and part of Ukraine which were most... Had the greatest proclivity towards Russia, most sympathetic to Russia, have been the bits that Russia has decided to basically completely destroy.
I have spoken to, I know many, many Ukrainians, and many I count as my close friends. I've spoken to Ukrainians who said before the invasion they were very pro-Russian. They have now turned 180 degrees. They have cut off ties, family ties from family in Russia and so on. And of course, the fifth lie is Ukraine is full of Nazis.
Yeah.
When 2019, you know, there's far right in every country, as you know, in Europe, the far right banded together to maximize their vote, and they got 2.04% of the vote, while Volodymyr Zelensky, a Jew of Russian origin and Russian speaking, got 73% of the vote in an election that was invigilated by the West and judged to be true and fair. There is not a Western democratic leader could dream of getting 73% of the popular vote.
Quite.
Some Nazi country.
Cormac, I'm really grateful to you for puncturing a few myths there. It's very, very, very helpful because they come up all of the time. And just specifically on that point that Cormac brings up about the real horror of Russian propaganda talking about Ukraine being full of Nazis. When they invoke that, they do so. Nazism is obviously, and Nazis are deeply powerful, politically potent terms throughout Europe, but nowhere more so than in Russia. Remember that 27 million Russians or citizens of the USSR died in the Second World War. 27 million. 30% of Western Russia was completely destroyed. So when Putin brings that up, he's doing so fully cognizant of what a deep, historic, cultural well he is mining, and he is drilling down into deep within the Russian psyche, accusing many Ukrainians, part of that number, by the way, killed and destroyed in the Second World War by Nazis. So to suggest that Ukraine is full of Nazis, absolutely historically outrageous. Talking about historically outrageous, Grant Shapps. No, it's a joke. Not really comparing Grant Shapps to that, don't worry. Grant Shapps, we've got a story about Grant Shapps this morning, or rather The Guardian does. The watchdog that monitors government ministers' professional appointments after leaving office has been criticised for clearing Grant Shapps, a former Conservative Defence Secretary, to join Cambridge Aerospace as long as he promises not to work on defence matters. This is part of an ongoing story, an ongoing matter, into basically what ministers do after they leave office and whether it is potentially improper, or at least has the air of impropriety. Aggie Chambray, LBC political correspondent, is here. Grant Shapps has got a new job, Aggie.
Grant Shapps.
What a relief. God.
For Grant Shapps, yes. So he is going to become, he has been cleared by ACABA to become chairman of the defence startup Cambridge Aerospace. Now, what is Cambridge Aerospace? It's difficult to find too much information about it because at the moment it is very much a startup.
Well,
Grant Shapps is going to be joining to help set it up as the chair. And what we can gather so far is that it's a defence startup. The company has said it's got one mission: to protect the UK and our allies from the well-known threats we face from the skies. Critics have pointed out that it's raised funds as a defence tech firm, and its product called Skyhammer is compared to a missile defence system. Now, I mention these things because he was, of course, defence secretary for a time when the Conservatives were in government. And he has basically been cleared on the proviso that he does this job. He's going to be chair, but he doesn't get involved in defence matters.
But it's a defence company.
It is a defence company.
That could be a bit tricky, couldn't it?
It does seem difficult. There were some slides in a presentation presented by Cambridge Aerospace where they said that they needed to prepare for a new era of warfare. Those were gathered by The Guardian. So I was speaking to a lady.
Maybe he's just like arranging their away days or something, you know, like he's just getting involved. He used to do all those WhatsApp groups with people. Maybe he's just doing all the WhatsApp stuff.
Possibly.
He's good at that.
But as chair, it does say, and I've read the advice from ACABA, it does basically say that he's going to be providing strategic direction and high-level advice. So I don't know how he's going to do that without getting involved.
So maybe not just the away days.
Defence. Not completely clear at this stage. I mean, he says he's joined it because he's always believed in the importance of protecting our civilian airspace. I believe that's only been strengthened.
What a noble impulse. We should all be thanking him, really. Give him a knighthood. Oh, wait, he's already got one for some reason.
Indeed, and a spokesperson for ACABA said that they've given Shapps advice not to engage in defence matters for 2 years. So we'll see how that works.
I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, Shapps was, I mean, going back to the super injunction story we did in July, Shapps was the defence secretary when he took out this, you know, constitutionally very unusual super injunction to hide the fact that the government had lost all of the data of so many Afghans, which has cost billions of pounds, etc., etc., etc. At the time, I recall when we were trying to get him to do an interview, he said he was too busy, and maybe because he was thinking he was on holiday, but you know, clearly not. He's obviously got a very busy diary. He's got this new job, so who can blame him, really, rather than giving a full account of his actions as a defence secretary? I mean, who are we to ask that, you know? Who are we?
Indeed.
A silence from Aggie Shombray. Sorry, that was just me on a little rant there. Just a little rant there. Aggie, thanks so much. I love you, political correspondent there, Aggie. Shombray just smiling gamefully as I sort of complete my rant about Grant Shapps. Might do it again in the next hour. It's 12 o'clock and obviously we're going to be talking about a different story in the next hour, which is, once again, the plight of NIMBYism in this country. It is 12 o'clock. It's LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midday, President Trump says the return of Crimea and membership of NATO won't be offered to Ukraine in any US brokered peace deal. Vladimir Zelensky is in Washington ahead of critical talks with Donald Trump about ending the conflict with Russia. Mr. Trump will also meet Keir Starmer and other European leaders separately who travelled to the US to support Ukraine. Ukrainian politician Hanna Hopko has told LBC Russia should not be given control of parts of eastern Ukraine.
Aggressor is stuck. Russia managed to occupy less than 1% of our territory during the last 1,000 days. So actually, of course, they want us to give up Donetsk region or Donbass territories without a fight. But it's not about ending the war. It's about preparing for bigger war, and I would add beyond Ukrainian territories.
Senior politicians in Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales are urging the Prime Minister to recall Parliament over the conflict in Gaza. They've written a letter to Sir Keir Starmer calling for immediate sanctions on Israel. Thousands of people gathered in Tel Aviv last night and yesterday to demonstrate against the conflict. Edith O'Hell is the mother of one of the Israeli hostages and says Israeli official claims that rallies will make a ceasefire with Hamas less likely is wrong.
I don't understand it. They knew there were going to be a protest. If they thought really that this protest will be dangerous or in some kind of way prolong the release of the hostages, they probably would have said something, you know. But I do know that, you know, my son is being tortured every day and he needs to come home. So what am I supposed to do?
A fourth man has been arrested by police investigating the death of a woman in East London. Police were called to Chadwell Heath in Romford in the early hours of Saturday following reports of an assault. One man's been arrested on suspicion of murder. Three others are being questioned on suspicion of assisting an offender. A man's been released on bail after being arrested over alleged racist abuse directed at the Bournemouth footballer Antoine Semenyo. A 47-year-old was detained after the forward reported alleged comments made during their Premier League game with Liverpool on Friday. And it's claimed the average UK house price has fallen by more than £10,000 over the summer. Rightmove says a decade-high number of homes on the market means sellers are pricing competitively and buyers are cashing in. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 7 points at 91.31. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, widespread sunshine will develop through the afternoon. Some thundery downpours possible in the southwest. Highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Thanks for a lovely evening. Would you like to come in for a coffee?
Yeah, okay. That'd be lovely.
Oh, gosh, sorry. I didn't mean... I just wanted you to see my new Wix kitchen. It's just been installed.
At Wix, our experts will support you every step of the way, from a free kitchen design service through to a professional installation. Plus, with our spend and save offer, there's up to 50% off kitchen units. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wix. Terms and minimum spend apply.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Lewis Goodall.
Time is 12:04. Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien all this week on LBC. Obviously, the Ukraine story is going to run and run today. Developments in the White House later, expecting some of the first pictures and meetings to take place about 4, 5, 6pm our time. That will obviously be covered completely comprehensively, I'm sure, by my colleagues on LBC throughout the rest of the day. So stay with us for updates on all of that. We're going to move on for the remainder of the show, though, and talk about something a little bit different. One of my hobby horses, and frankly, if this isn't an opportunity to get on one's personal hobby horse, then I don't know what is. James O'Brien's been doing it for 20 years, so you can forgive me an hour. This is Rachel Reeves preparing to strip back environmental protections in an effort to boost the economy by speeding up infrastructure projects. She's vowing to clamp down on all of the restrictions on bats and newts in a boost to developers. The Chancellor is considering reforms that would make it far harder for concerns about nature to stop development, which she is insisting is crucial to restoring growth and improving living standards. Though, of course, the political context to all of this is a really ever-worsening economic, macroeconomic situation. Ahead of that budget in October, it feels quite familiar to what happened last year. Much worsening public finance predictions, worsening slackening growth, which is feeding into all of that, higher borrowing costs, people talking about us being stuck in an economic doom loop, maybe even getting into a stagflationary situation. The Treasury is therefore looking around for every single possible lever it might be able to pull to try and generate some growth in an increasingly sclerotic British economy. Treasury has therefore begun preparing for another, because we've only just had one, another planning reform bill, and is thinking indeed about making use of Brexit-related freedoms and tearing up key parts of European environmental rules that developers say are making it harder to build key projects. Labour ministers have repeatedly insisted, for their part, of course, that the current planning overhaul won't come at the expense of Britain's natural biodiversity and nature. Promises a win-win system where developers will pay to offset environmental damage. But the Chancellor is believed to think that the government should go significantly further than that to which it has hitherto gone, even in the last year since its election, and has apparently been expressing frustration in private that the interests of, quote, bats and newts are being allowed to stymie critical infrastructure. And she's asked her officials to look at much more contentious reforms than the government has countenanced so far, which are likely to provoke something of a backlash, certainly from environmentalists and perhaps even some Labour MPs. There is currently a smaller UK list of protected species being planned, which would basically place less weight on wildlife, including types of newt. Never thought I'd say newt so many times on the radio. It's rare elsewhere in Europe, but it is common in Britain. Developers under these proposals would no longer have to prove that projects would have no impact on protected natural sites under plans that would abolish the precautionary principle enshrined in European rules. So therefore, basically, although no decisions have been made yet, this is being heavily briefed, so we can imagine something like this will happen. Basically, the proposals are to significantly loosen environmental protections. Now, I know there are going to be lots of people, and I should have some sympathy with this myself. You know, Britain is relatively, in terms of our biodiversity nature, it is pretty depleted, and that's been getting worse in lots of areas for many years. I can understand the concerns about all of this. But I have to say that the presumption for me, I mean, Britain's planning system is very heavily regulated. It is strict by comparison to other European countries and certainly by comparison to the United States. Remember that we have relatively unusually a planning system that is so unusually discretionary. We don't do what the US does, for example, where you have like fixed zoning rules like a lot of Europe does or the US. Where you basically say this is residential development, this is commercial and whatever. You know, we do something, development requires case-by-case permission, and that gives councils enormous power to block or delay projects. And often spurious reasons or relatively limited reasons can be used to block those things. And we know the impact that that has had. We've got 13% of England and Wales covered by the Green Belt. That's an enormous amount, often of not especially attractive land. Sometimes when you go through, we've had a mistake, I think, in this country of treating every field or every hedge or whatever it happens to be as somehow as being beyond the pale of development. Whereas the truth is, nature is not always nature. I'm always struck by the number of people who walk down or post pictures of a landscape in England which is just composed of sort of fields devoid of trees, devoid of much plant life or whatever, and go, oh, isn't that beautiful? Well, not really. The truth is that that's just as industrialized in some ways as an urban environment. It's certainly a very human environment, because guess what? England didn't look like that in its natural state. We were an island of endless woodland and forest and temperate rainforest. That's all long gone. I would much rather us spend more time thinking about how to restore parts of our natural landscape than worry about every field that might go to development, because we know the cost. We've got a generation, two generations of young people who are being denied their future because our housing situation is so profoundly bad, who have been priced out of housing in this country. And that is not just about development, and it's not just about planning rules, but a lot of it is, quite a bit of it is. And that often goes down to planning committees having too much power, comprised of older people who will find any excuse, including relatively unimportant bits of wildlife, to prevent development, because they've already got their houses, they've already got their what they need for their lives. Their children don't, their grandchildren don't, but that can be an element of what I would say generational selfishness. Is the Chancellor right? I want to talk to you about this. Is the Chancellor right to say that really environmental protection should take the back seat or go on the back burner by comparison to the importance of development? Have we protected relatively unimportant bits of wildlife too much for too long in this country at the expense of things which arguably are more important, which is getting kids, young people homes, making sure that we've got infrastructure that takes this country into the 21st century? What is one of the reasons that HS2 has proven so expensive? It's by no means the only reason, but the planning system has made it very, very difficult and expensive to get it built, partly as a result of concerns for biodiversity and nature. Should we be prioritising development over wildlife? 0345 6060973, 0345 6060973. Let's talk to Ed Molyneux now, Public Affairs Manager at the Campaign to Protect Rural England. Ed, I suspect you might be quite unhappy by this briefing.
Good morning, Lewis. I think it's more sort of disbelief, really, than unhappiness. I think, broadly, the government have a planning bill currently in Parliament. They are planning to reduce planning protections in that. It has yet to pass Parliament. It was not due to pass through Parliament until November. And already they're coming back and asking for more.
That is the thing that surprises me as well. It's considering we have got a planning bill which is going through Parliament, yeah. Might it not be best to augment that rather than starting another one?
They can still propose amendments to it, and they could do so. But also, how can we say we haven't done enough when we have yet to see the impact of this bill first. And remember, 3 or 4 years ago, the last government passed their own levelling up and regeneration bill, attempting to do exactly the same thing. So too often, I think, we tweak the system around the edges rather than, you know, actually working out why we're not building. And part of that problem is because developers build when they make money, and they don't, and they aren't forced to build on their planning applications that come in. So lots of planning applications are approved. I think about 86% of all applications are approved generally. That was in, that was a year or two ago, and yet they're not built out. And we need to, one, on the one hand, we do need development, but two, we need to hold accountable the developers who are getting permissions, but not then developing what they're saying they will.
I think that's completely right, and it is a really important part of the other side of the ledger, which is that the current planning system, and it's actually one of the problems with the current planning system, which is it basically favours developers, sort of established developers so much, so we end up with 6 or 8 big companies who basically build inadequate housing, poor housing, and so on. And the planning system should be made much easier to help people build their own homes, self-build, small developers, all of those sorts of things. So you're in complete agreement there. But what do you make of the briefing that is, I mean, several papers have picked up on it today, so it's clearly something that's going on in government, that the Chancellor in particular is focusing and has this frustration about what is, in her view, too much focus on bats and newts?
Well, I think broadly, When you're doing development in your own house, first you look to minimise as much damage as you can, whether that's doing no damage at all. So I've just decorated this room, and what we do is we make sure we're not going to do any damage, and then we look to mitigate. And what the Chancellor's suggesting is that we get rid of that initial presumption not to do any damage, and instead go straight to the mitigation. Now, when I'm doing development and want to do development, ideally I want, you know, things developed, but also the area around it protected and enhanced. Lots of development near where I live has lots of new nature-friendly land alongside large brownfield development, which is really positive. And that's the sort of way we should be developing. The idea that, oh, nature and development are in disagreement is wrong. We need to do both. We need to protect and enhance our environment. As you said, you know, our nature is really declining, but also we need to build things. And there's a good balance to get between those. But instead, the government seems intent on...
Can you do that?
Yeah, no, I think you absolutely can. I think, one, you focus on developing previously developed land, if you can. And then, two, when you're building on non-previously developed land, you make sure that developers do the right thing.
And what does that look like? What does that look like, practically, to balance those things?
I think broadly we're seeing some changes in the new planning infrastructure bill. So things like the Nature Restoration Fund, which you touched on, could, if done right, ensure that we get nice development. My council, as I said, when they've built new development near me, there's some old military barracks as they developed, they've insisted that also we get nature land that people can access. Because I couldn't agree with you more that lots of land we protect isn't accessible to people. And that is a silly thing to do. We need to make sure that lots more land is opened up so people can enjoy it, especially if we're going to build houses near it, so they are not locked in their houses and not able to get anywhere and enjoy the natural environment they have.
Is there a way of actually, I mean, I suppose the what the Chancellor would say is that if you, there's this perception that if you build houses in a way which is friendly to nature, that's going to add more cost, and that's going to actually act as a disincentive to build more. Why is that wrong?
Well, I mean, developers aren't building now. Like, broadly, it doesn't seem to be a problem in the environmental regulations. Developers have consistently not built. They have significant amounts of planning measures that aren't being built because, for some reason, as you say, we rely on a very small amount of developers to build all our homes, rather than, as we have done in the past, the government building homes, or encouraging more small and medium-sized developers, more self-build, as you touched on as well. But instead, we have a system where we rely on a very small amount of companies who essentially are out in it for themselves. They build houses at the rate they can make the most money from them. And that's a silly way to... And then we wonder why we're not building enough houses.
I suppose, what the Chancellor might have in mind is these stories which come up now and again, and maybe they're the exception rather than the rule, but nonetheless, they generate some heat. I mean, you know, for example, when we're talking about HS2, obviously the story in November saying that HS2 was spending £100 million on a shield to protect bats in ancient woodland in Buckinghamshire. Now, maybe that's good and maybe that's important, but it does become a bit of a symbol for and a sort of encapsulation of kind of how onerous some of these restrictions are. And when you've got HS2 spending £100 million on protecting bats, people might wonder whether that is the best value for money.
Well, look, looking at HS2, I don't think anyone can say that's an example of a well-developed piece of infrastructure at all.
No.
I think, you know...
You have to be mad.
Exactly. The bat tunnel aside, I think the reason why HS2 cost a lot of money is because it's been poorly managed from the start. You know, as I say, I'll go back to the data, which is that 86 plenty planning applications are approved. About 2.7% of the refusals are overturned at appeal. And so I think what it means is that there's just not that many applications that have, you know, that are overturned and not built.
But it could be, so, but it could be that there are applications which are frankly never made because it's such an onerous process. Again, it goes back to the fact that it's very much weighted in favour of companies and people who have means and are able to make those changes.
No, I don't disagree with the point about big companies being favoured in the planning system. But you know, there are 1 million homes, you know, in the planning pipeline not built. That's 2/3 of the government's own housing target for this parliament. And so, if they built them, then the government would be well on the way to doing it. But instead, they go, "Well, we're not getting enough applications through. Let's get more applications in." And they're making changes to do just that with the planning infrastructure bill, and that hasn't happened yet, and yet we're already looking again at changing the system. Let's let the first changes bed in. Let's see if they work for how the government wants them to work. And they've also, you know, said that it's going to be a win-win for nature, and they've made some changes based on organisations like Mind's concerns about that, and we're happy with them. And so broadly, if this works, it could be it. But instead, the government go, "Oh, well, it's not enough," even though they have yet to finish the first project they've started. It seems completely bonkers to me.
Ed Molyneux there, Public Affairs Manager at the Campaign to Protect Rural England. What are your views on all of this? Are our rules in this country, are they weighted far too in favour, not only of vested interest when building housing, but frankly, in protecting some rather unimpressive and unimportant bits of our natural world? And that includes land and some of the species that live there. Commonplace, things that are commonplace. If, for example, there does happen to be, I don't know, some badgers living in a particular area where you want to develop, should that be a problem? Should that really be a problem? Or bats, or wherever it happens to be? What do we prioritise? And do we prioritise something, not just wildlife too much, but I would argue that half of the time the wildlife is used as a protection or as a means just from people who don't really care about those things. They just don't want to see those houses built in the first place. And they alight upon, they choose to use any particular degradation that might happen in a natural world around it to try and stop this happening or stop houses being happening. And we know the cost of that. We know the cost of that is that we are setting up generation after generation which has no prospect of having somewhere decent to live to call their own. Isn't this just yet another example? The Chancellor is right. This is just another example of NIMBY power. 0345-609-6093, 0345-60-60973. You're listening to Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien this week on RBC. The time has just turned 12:20.
This is LBC. Listen on the move with the all-new LBC app. Download it for free from the App Store.
There are days when you're hungry for McDonald's. Then there are days when you're big arch hungry for McDonald's. You'll get to know the difference. New Big Arch for big McDonald's hunger. Until 9th of September, from 11 a.m, participating restaurants only, subject to availability.
So, what are you watching at the moment?
Squid Game, Dad.
Let's watch it together this weekend. That'd be nice. What's it on again?
Netflix. You've got EETV, so you just switch it on.
What season are we up to?
4. That's Stranger Things, Mum.
And what about the kids?
Don't worry, they'll watch Cocomelon for the 100th time.
Switch on Netflix with EETV. Plus, change up sports and entertainment. It's TV with the ultimate flex for the whole family.
EETV requires EE broadband. Separate 24-month contracts for TV and broadband. Content may vary, terms apply.
Chase is the digital bank that puts you first.
What does that mean?
Well, most people don't bank 9 to 5. That's why Chase customer support is available 24/7.
So I can contact them whenever works best for me.
You've got it. You can chat to a real person through the app.
That's handy.
And you can always call up to speak with them directly.
Hello. Now we're talking.
Join the UK's number one bank for customer satisfaction. Chase. See what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents. Eligibility applies. Claim based on YouGov UK Banks and Building Society's rankings 2024. Verify at chase.co.uk/YouGov.
How will you react if you win big with Win Plus?
I can't believe it!
Enter now at winplus.co.uk to get in the draw. 18 plus GB only. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall. Call 0345 60 60973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Time is nearly 12:22. Just as an example of kind of what I'm talking about here and why our system, I think, is completely weighted in favour of older people, people who don't want development. Let's just go through what you have to do. If you're a minor housing developer, you're trying to build 8-10 homes or whatever it happens to be. This is what you have to do, right? What you have to do in order to get that done. Bear in mind, basically, you are dealing with, in the UK, one of the most tightly regulated planning environments in the world. And there are legal, political, financial, and practical difficulties, right? So first of all, as we say, the UK system, unlike much of Europe or the US, it's not zoning, where basically they just say, well, you can develop sort of commercial properties here or residential properties here or industrial, and that makes it all much simpler. In England and most of the UK, every major project requires individual approval. Then there are local plans. Councils set out where they expect development, but those plans are often out of date or vague or they're contested. Then there's the application process. You need to submit proposals covering layout, design, environmental impact, traffic studies. Then there are consultations. Local residents and interest groups can object, and they often do, and that leads to delays. Each of the objections have to be addressed and contested and argued about and delayed or denied or neutralised or agreed to or disagreed with. There's the Green Belt. If you're planning to build on the Green Belt, that's 13% of England, by the way, building's almost impossible unless it's under very special circumstances, which themselves are vague and contested. There are national parks and areas of outstanding natural beauty, SSSIs, even stricter, basically a ban on any development at all. There are heritage protections, listed buildings, conservation areas, archaeological sites, historic landscapes. Then there's environmental impact assessments, EIAs, required for large projects covering biodiversity, flood risk, pollution, traffic, nutrient neutrality rules. In some areas, housing is blocked unless developers can prove no net increase in nitrogen or phosphorus runoff into rivers. Building regulations, fire safety, energy efficiency, accessibility, sustainability standards, infrastructure contributions, Section 106 agreements, the community infrastructure levy, and on it goes. Can you imagine anyone building anything? You just look at that and think, you know what, I won't bother. You know what, I'm going home. I'm going to go and sell lemonade from a street corner somewhere. Because honestly, and each one of those things can be valuable and important. But what it does lead to is an enormous inhibition and impediment to development, to be honest, from the sort of people we would probably like development from, which is smaller developers who probably are more minded to build properly or build beautifully or whatever it happens to be. So all you end up with instead is the big six housing developers coming along and building boxes in the middle of nowhere, which are ugly, which we don't have infrastructure, which aren't the sort of built homes that people want to build in and live in for a long time. So that's the problem. We've got a system which is weighted towards the powerful local objectors and the powerful house builders. And what we need is to fundamentally reform it so we get something new. And that will probably involve some compromises, I think, on some of the natural nature-related regulations, because we can't go on as we are. Your thoughts on this, 0345-6060-973. Glenn is in Wakefield. Glenn. Good afternoon.
Oh, good morning, Lewis. Yeah, good morning, Lewis. Or afternoon. It's really good to speak to you. You've just basically outlined exactly the obstacles that I've faced recently. I'm a small builder. I don't really do house building, but I do the odd one now and again. And I've just put an application in recently in Wakefield for a house, for a new house in the garden of my own home. The first obstacle that I faced was, and really it's just the experience that I wanted to share, was about this new policy about biodiversity net gain, where you're expected to demonstrate that you can add 10% biodiversity to the site. Well, the first thing you do is you might take a tree down, cut back a hedge, take the grass up, so straight away you're into the negative. My architect told me that it's almost impossible to achieve, so you end up buying biodiversity net gain credits off-site, maybe a Scottish estate or reintroducing otters, so you contribute the cost towards that. The architect,
so you have to prove, so just to be clear, Glenn, because most people obviously will have no idea, you have to prove that you're basically, via your development in some way, not just having a sort of net zero impact on it, as it were, to coin that phrase, but actually net improving biodiversity.
A net improvement of 10%. And
how are you supposed to do that?
Well, my architect told me it's virtually impossible. You can put all sorts of schemes in place with hedgehog hotels and squirrel bridges. You can't achieve it, so you end up buying the credits off-site. The architect told me to expect about £30,000. Now, if that's not an obstacle, and this is on top of CIL, all the other things that you listed previously that are obstacles in the way, and I just look at it and I just think, it's just not worth it. You cannot make it pay. I was with, the other thing I just wanted to add was I was with a good friend of mine who is a house builder yesterday, who been approached about a plot. It was for 60 houses, 60 new homes, and they were not able to offer £1 to buy the site because of all the things that we've just listed. Biodiversity net gain being the prime one. Section 106 costs, just all the things that you listed that are massive obstacles.
I think, Glenn, you're proving my point, really. I just don't see it. If you're not one of the big house builders, which I won't name, but you know, people know the companies. I think unless you're a company with that sort of means and you've basically got a kind of, it's like clockwork, you know how it all works. How could anyone build anything?
It's almost impossible, and you've just hit the nail on the head. It is someone who's doing a site for maybe 500 houses where that cost can be spread. They can make it pay. They can spread it over a bigger number of houses. But you know, to me, the friend yesterday that I mentioned that's looking at 60 houses, and it's just not worth their while to do it.
Building 60 houses isn't worth your while.
It's not worth their while doing it. And as I say, but you know, it's a time when we're trying to make homes. All our kids want a home. Where are they going to be? Yeah. It breaks my heart to see stifling entrepreneurs. I see myself as a small entrepreneur.
I had
a bit of a go, try and build a house. And now and again, it's not my prime objective. I do small building works, but now and again, you have a go, entrepreneurially, and it's just not worth it. And it's just such a shame because you would be providing the houses that are so badly needed.
I think, Glenn, this is exactly the point. This is why we end up with these houses, which frankly are pretty unattractive, right? And like unappealing, you know, just house after house on massive kind of like in the middle of the nowhere, big estates, and they're just box houses that look the same as everywhere else, because this is what we basically encourage in our system to provide, because smaller builders like yourself or smaller developers like yourself who actually might develop something interesting and worthwhile and something a bit close to the ground and what people want, it's basically impossible for you to break into.
Again, a frustration of mine was we wanted to do something a little bit individual, a little bit attractive, try and put an individual stamp on it. And by using something that was a brick that didn't fit in with all the other houses that were in the locality, can't do it. It's got to match all the other houses. Completely stifles any kind of individuality. It's just a tragic shame. It's the numbers of houses to me that we've got the capability as a country to be able to build that is hugely stifled. Nobody wants to see biodiversity being destroyed, trampled on, getting rid of animals. Obviously, that nobody would be in favour of that. But the priority has got to be providing homes for people, to me.
I agree. Well, Glenn, complete agreement with you singing to the converted there. Glenn in Wakefield there, who had a brilliant call because it exactly encapsulates exactly the problem. Glenn, a man who wants to, you know, small-scale developer, and it's exactly what we should be encouraging. We need to be encouraging the planning system growth by not just being weighted in favour of vested interests. That is so much of the problem with so much of our country at the moment, particularly economically speaking. The entire system is weighted towards the powerful, the already powerful, the already wealthy, the people who know how to navigate bureaucracy and regulation in that way. When we overregulate and there is too much bureaucracy, it is exactly the person like Glenn who is basically disincentivized from trying to grow their business because it just becomes not worth your while. And the net externality of that, the net result of that, is we don't end up, in this case, in this market, with enough homes for kids to grow up in. And we end up with the wrong sort of homes, which are basically being built for the profits and the advantage of the big developers. Your thoughts on all this? 0345 60 60 973. We're going to be talking to Sasha Lord in a moment, of course, the nighttime czar, best sort of czar in my experience, up in Greater Manchester, about the closure that seems to be of 8 pubs a week, which appears to be taking place at the moment, with warnings of the decimation of much of Britain's nighttime economy. Talking to him shortly. At 12:31, though, let's get the very latest LBC News headlines with Amelia Cox.
Donald Trump says Ukraine will not be granted NATO membership as part of any US-brokered peace deal with Russia. He's posted online ahead of a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky in Washington later. A man has been found guilty over the shooting of a 9-year-old girl and 3 men outside a restaurant in East London. Javon Riley was involved in the planned assassination of rival gang members in Hackney in May 2024. And Keir Starmer has been urged to recall Parliament to impose immediate sanctions on Israel in a letter signed by senior politicians. The signatories include the SNP's leader in Westminster, Northern Ireland's First Minister and the leader of Plaid Cymru. LBC weather, plenty of sunshine in the west this afternoon, staying mostly cloudy further east, a few heavy and thundery showers in the southwest of England, highs of 26 degrees.
This is LBC.
Who's a good human? Alex is. Because today's dog walk with Lulu the Corgi has turned into an off-road adventure. But wherever Lulu's nose takes her, Alex will always gladly follow. That's why he also chooses Butternut Box for Lulu's meals. Freshly prepared and served straight from the fridge. Helping Lulu thrive from nose to tail. Meaning one less trek for Alex as we deliver each box straight to your door. Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
At EDF, we don't just encourage you to use less electricity. We actually reward you for it. That's why when you use less during peak times on weekdays, we give you free electricity on Sundays. How you use it is up to you. EDF. Change is in our power. Households who reduce their weekday peak electricity usage by 50% can earn up to 16 hours of free electricity per week, subject to fair usage. For all T's and C's, visit edfenergy.com/r-power.
Okay, train from London to peaceful Peterborough.
Neem Park this way, huh?
Gorgeous. Wow. Never thought I'd be this into bird watching.
Did you see it? Lovely plumage.
Train home. Brilliant day. Oh, gotta rent bikes next time to see the big lake. And more birds, obviously.
Download the Thameslink Railway app and save with advanced tickets. Thameslink Railway, where every stop is a story. Terms apply. See our website for full details.
At This Vet, Mia's the owner, surgeon, rotor manager and puppy wrangler. And now she and her team are cybersecurity experts too.
Mia, someone tried accessing our system. Phishing scam. I blocked it.
BT Security Awareness Training turns your team into your first line of defence. Quick to set up from just £1.25 per user per month. Cybersecurity is everyone's business. Thankfully, not just Mia's. Search BT Business Cybersecurity. T&Cs apply. Prices exclude VAT at 20%. 12-month minimum term applies.
Lewis Goodall on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
Time is 12:34. A few of your messages on this planning story. Mark says, "Hi, Lewis. The problem with planning isn't bats, toads and newts. It's landowners. They have too much power. But then again, that's no surprise, is it?" All the best, Mark in Congleton there. Aldo says, "So once again, this government is the at last are willing to destroy everything rather than taxing the ultra wealthy to pay their share to help in the absolute destruction of our economy just to avoid the EU tax laws. Wow, just wow. This will be a deserted island in the next 100 to 200 years. Well, I suppose our housing problem will be solved then, won't it, Aldo? We live wherever we like. Everyone decamping off to Belgravia. John says, "I broadly agree with your concerns about housing, Lewis, but we also have millions of empty and derelict houses. Why the government doesn't incentivise landlords to restore these and make them available is beyond me." Well, John, part of it, again, will be the planning system. It's really hard. You have to deal with the land registry. Believe me, I know about that at the moment for various reasons which don't need to detain us. Land registry, dealing with all sorts of different bits and pieces, like getting actual permission, listed building and whatever. So even if someone wants to restore some of these houses, it can actually be very practically difficult. And Penny, with a particularly inspiring contribution today, says, "Yay, let's concrete over it all." You know what, Penny? I'm with you. Let's do it. I don't care. Let's just do it. Let's concrete over it all. Or at least, let's concrete over the bits that aren't very impressive. This is the thing that really winds me up. Sometimes people treat every little bit of countryside or every bit of nature as if, you know, it's the Yorkshire Dales or the Lake District or the Peak District or wherever it happens to be, as if it's completely and utterly some sort of nirvana or Eden. It's not. Some of this bit of places are just scragland, really. There's nothing there. It's certainly not very natural. It's just fields. It's just farmland. Farmland, of course, can be important and is important. But sometimes some of this stuff is not beautiful. It's heavily mechanized. It's very industrial. It's basically, it's nothing that natural about it. It was robbed of its natural world and natural beauty long ago by human development. So really, you're just swapping one form of development with another form of development. There is nothing intrinsically beautiful about a field. controversial opinion of the week already. And it's only Monday. 0345 and all this 60973. Something which won't be controversial, though, is sadness, I think, about the number of pubs which are apparently ceasing trading across the UK. 8 pubs a week apparently closing across the UK during the first half of 2025. That's new figures revealing that as the industry grapples with escalating tax and labour costs. Industry leaders have described the trend as heartbreaking, urging the Treasury to implement supportive tax measures in the upcoming autumn budget. Official government statistics showing that 209 pubs either being demolished, repurposed for other uses in the 6 months leading up to June. That is, of course, part of a much longer trend where the total number of pubs in England and Wales, including those vacant or available to let, fell to 38,000. Since the beginning of 2020, 2,283 pubs just since 2020 have permanently disappeared from communities across England and Wales. Let's talk now to Sasha Lord, Chair of the Nighttime Industry Association, former Nighttime Economy Advisor in Greater Manchester, with Andy Burnham. Mayor Andy Burnham, of course. Sasha, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon now. This is a picture you recognise in your neck of the woods?
It is, Lewis, and it's heartbreaking, isn't it? Some of the stats that you read out then, we are losing 8 pubs a week. And, you know, just to put things into perspective, in 2009, the profit on a pint was 84p. This year, 2025, the profit on a pint is 12p. We're being taxed to the hilt. We've never been taxed
and
this
why,
much.
What, what's the, and is that tax-related mainly? The profit element?
It is. It absolutely. It's the duty we've been squeezed on. We had business rates discounts at 75%, and that's now dropped to 40%. We've obviously got the national insurance increase, and it's devastating the industry. And especially an industry that welcomes so many young people. It might be their first job or the weekend job or a job to get them through college. That stops at the moment. There aren't jobs out there.
Is it partly, though? I mean, it is. It's obviously, you know, pubs are often part of the big part of the local community. They're sort of historically yes. English, British thing, and they're often beloved by lots of people. But isn't the truth perhaps that, you know, habits have changed, haven't they? People don't go to the pub as much anymore than they might drink at home. There's a lot less drinking among younger people as well than compared to there used to be. So this is a reflection. It may be that there's a tax element to it, but it's also a reflection of changing habits.
I think you're right. I think pubs actually are standing up on their own, albeit not making any money.
Much better compared to nightclubs, for example.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right. Nightclubs and bars, so places where you can go for a drink, but it's not a traditional pub, they really are having a tough time at the moment. And, you know, it's estimated that if nightclubs continue to close on the trajectory that they are at the moment, by the end of 2029, there will not be one nightclub left in the UK.
Wow, really?
Really. And, you know, I'd hoped so much that this would be, as promised, the government for small business. And it's just not the case.
And why do you think that is on nightclubs? Because it's just that young people just aren't going out in the way they used to.
I think it's a hangover from the COVID period.
Yeah.
You know, that whole period where kids were locked up for 2 years. Just habits have changed. People are just not interested in going out till 4 or 5 in the morning. Having said that, there is an explosion at the moment of day parties and especially parties for over 30s.
Right. That's good news.
We're seeing a
Where
huge,
are they?
Huge
I'll just
comeback.
Take a note.
we are seeing a huge comeback in us at the moment. So it's interesting. It's interesting. People are diverting and changing.
You mentioned the tax element. I mean, there have actually been rumours and suggestions that perhaps one way that the Chancellor might try to excavate herself from the fiscal hole in which she finds herself is sort of increases in so-called sin taxes, you know, cigarettes, alcohol yes. duties and so on. If that were to happen, what do you think the impact would be on this clearly already worsening picture?
Well, I'll give you a comparison at the moment. The alcohol duty on a pint in the UK is 20 times more than it is in Germany.
Wow, really? I had no idea.
It is. And every single summer I get people saying to me, I've just been somewhere in Spain and how come it's only €3 for a pint and I'm paying £6.50 in the pub over here? In London now I'm hearing prices of £8. For a pint, which is extortionate. And that is the reason why we've been taxed. And we're getting to the stage now where it's becoming unviable for the customer to actually go out. So yes, you know, we are seeing people buy from supermarkets that aren't taxed as much and drink at home. It's actually more dangerous, and the NHS backed that figure up as well, because you don't have any peer pressure, people monitoring what you drink at home, you're just drinking and drinking, Whereas, you know, in the pub, you don't want to be seen as that person that's drinking pint after pint after pint.
Is part of the picture, Sasha? I don't know this, and so if you can elucidate me, it would be very, very helpful. Is part of this that people don't want to run pubs anymore? Is it that that's actually kind of like a it's difficult work, it's hard work, there isn't much profit in it for sure, as you've said. So that actually part of it, some of it is demand, but some of it is supply.
It absolutely is. People are working, you know, 18-hour days at the moment.
Yeah, it's long.
For no profit whatsoever.
Unsociable hours in the sense that you're just watching other people socialise or facilitating people.
And that, you know, I'll be honest, Lewis, I had to turn off my DMs on Twitter because I was getting messages from people who, it was their home, they were living above their pub, they had the family there and they were losing their home. And it was heartbreaking for me to see this thing. And then when you think about the community value and the social value that these pubs bring, it is immense. You know, a pub is not just about a pint. How many times have we walked into a pub and we'll see an older person sat there nursing a pint for 2 hours. There's a chronic pandemic at the moment of loneliness in the UK, and places like that help.
What do you think the government should do? Try and arrest it. Is it arrestable as a decline?
It is. I know what I'd like them to do, but I don't think they'll do it.
Well, go on. They might be listening. The Chancellor might be listening, Sasha, so you've got her here.
Reverse the NI increase. That's it.
Oh, really?
Reintroduce.
Well, they're definitely not going to do that.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Exactly.
You were right.
Yes. Yeah, that would do it.
Do you think that has actually been devastating?
Absolutely. No one saw that coming. There was a rumour about the business rates. No one saw the NI increase coming. And actually, the other one that they will never do is, like the previous government did, to help coming out of COVID, reduce VAT for a temporary period. We're paying 20% in the UK. Colleagues across Europe are paying between 7% and 8%. There's a specific hospitality tax. There are mechanisms, but I'm confident none of them will be used.
Well, that's a nice uplifting note on which to end. Sasha Lord there, chair of the Nighttime Industry Association, former Knight Tsar in Greater Manchester for Andy Burnham, of course. Bit of bad news, perhaps, for President Zelensky. It has been confirmed that one J.D. Vance, the vice president, is going to be attending the meeting at the Oval Office later today. Obviously, we all know that didn't go down terribly well before. And there is also, of course, rumours. This will be something to look out for later. Lots of rumours that, indeed, President Zelensky is going to turn up in a suit on the basis of what we saw last time, which is, of course, he was harangued by Vice President Vance for not wearing a suit when he turned up to the Oval Office, despite the fact, of course, many people before and since have done so. But nonetheless, he was harangued. I wouldn't be surprised at all if he ditches his trademark military fatigues in exchange for a suit in the name of getting any scrap of favour that he or the Ukrainians or the Europeans can from the core of King Donald. Want your thoughts for the rest of the show on this NIMBY question. Maybe if you've got a thought on pubs as well, if you've run a pub yourself over the course of whether in the past or whether now, and whether you're thinking about it's whether it's worth it anymore. 0345 60 60 973. It's Lewis Goodall sitting in for James O'Brien all this week, and the time is bang on, and you don't get that with James O'Brien. Bang on 12:45.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
The unusual journey en masse of European leaders to Washington tells us something, but what? That Trump is serious about ending the war, or Keir Starmer and his counterparts are panicking?
Sheila Fogarty on LBC.
Who's a good human? Jenny is, because Jenny will always do what's best for Bertie, her bestie Bassett. So if Bertie needs to go and wee, that's what they're going to do. Even if it is 3 a.m. and it's raining cat lots. That's why she also chooses Butternut Box for Bertie's meals. Freshly prepared, served straight from the fridge, and conveniently delivered right to your door. At a time that suits you for once. Hey, Jenny.
Oh.
Ready to join thousands of good humans? Go to butternutbox.com to fetch 25% off your first box with code GOODHUMAN.
Brands that use radio are 49% more likely to get noticed. Amplify your advertising at radiocentre.org. Assuming you want to get noticed.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Emma from Leeds. Talk to me.
Sir, I had 2 doorbells, but Claire had 5. And it's not like I'm there counting. Well, OK, I guess I am. But for her to want me to pay half the bill...
I'm losing it. Doorbells. She should just do what I do. Bank with Monzo and share the bill in the app. Split it fairly down to the dough ball and get paid straight away. Easy.
And she had tiramisu.
Monzo, split bills in seconds. UK residents, T's and C's apply.
So, close your eyes. Picture the scene. Just you and me, alone, enjoying breakfast on our own little island. Sounds perfect, right?
Yeah.
Great, because I've booked Wickes to design our new kitchen.
At Wickes, we have over 70 kitchen styles to choose from, with prices from under £3,000 to over £20,000. And with our spend and save offer, there's up to 50% off kitchen units. Book a free design appointment and feel as proud as a peacock with Wickes. Terms and minimum spend apply.
Save this bank holiday with Lidl. Bring the heat with 2 for £7 on barbecue meats like burgers, jumbo sausages and more holiday heroes. Only with Lidl Plus. Now that's big on quality and always Lidl on price. Download Lidl Plus and start saving this bank holiday.
18 plus GB only while stocks last. Terms apply. See lidl.co.uk/lptv. Offer ends 27th of August.
A southern train is a place where family moments become more peaceful. Where you can spread out and a game of I Spy gets a scenic upgrade with snacks, stories and the occasional sheep for a bonus point. Less stress, more yes with kids tickets for £2 at southernrailway.com. Terms apply.
This is LBC with Lewis Goodall.
Time has just turned 12:48. There is a connection between that story which we were just hearing about, the decline of the number of pubs and generally the nighttime economy in the UK, and the planning NIMBY situation that we've been talking about as well. Because anyone who has gone out in central London, for example, or tried to any much time past sort of 11, 12 o'clock, certainly midnight, and struggled to find a bar open or somewhere to eat or whatever, these things are related, because whenever anyone in, say, central London or Soho or wherever it happens to be asks for longer licensing hours, or indeed when there was the al fresco dining, which took place just after the pandemic, which made the city much nicer, much lighter, you were able to dine outside, help those small businesses stay open, whatever, who objects? Who objects? The people who live in Soho. I remember there was this association of people who live in Soho complaining about the noise. You live in Soho. You don't need to live in Soho. You can literally live anywhere else in the country, and guess what? It will be quiet at night. You know where it probably ought not to be quiet at night? Soho. And yet, who won in the end? The NIMBYs did, because they always win, because it is so weighted in their favour. So there is a connection between these two things. Again, a system which is weighted in the favour of those who already have homes, who are probably older, have already lived their lives, whatever, etc., etc. And it is all weighted in their favour. And it's wrong. Not least because half the time the planning committees, which are occupied by, guess what, exactly those sorts of people. It's crazy. Luke is in Preston. Luke, afternoon.
Hi there, Lewis. How's things?
Oh, yeah, not bad, thank you. Not bad. Now, I've got all that off my chest now, so I feel much better.
I live in Cardiff, and I'm a landowner in Cardiff.
Right.
And we're currently just... I just wanted to reiterate your point on the Big Six and the amount of push and pull.
This
that
is
the
Big Six housing firms, the companies which dominate house building in England and Wales.
Completely dominate. So we've got a small plot of land, just under 4 acres, and what are we in 2025? So 5 years ago in South Wales, they have what they call a local development plan, and it's a plan for the next 15 years. The what's residential building, what residential plots that are going to happen, anything over 10 houses are going to happen over the next 15 years. And it's just how backwards it completely is. You know, we've applied for a modest 47 houses on this 4-acre site. And, we're basically being shut down, where you've got Taylor Wimpey across the road with 100 metre distance, we're building 8,000 houses. There's Redrow, probably 500 metres down the road, building another 2,000 houses. It's completely backwards. And there is no push and pull with the planning department. You know, they just don't like giving small builders, small landowners, the opportunity to build houses, which we could probably turn around quicker than the bigger guys.
And what is it like as a smaller business trying to navigate the system, the sort of planning system, Luke?
Well, you know, we've had to seek, outside help. So we've had planning consultants come in. We've had ecological surveys done. We've had people camping out on the land, watching the bats and the mice. It's just, it's absolute, it's It's carnage, you know, and...
Luke, you remind me of... I mean, actually, you know, it's not just a commercial thing, right? Anyone who's tried to buy a house in this country knows how many weird layers you have to go through, how many people you have to employ, and solicitors and conveyancers and assessors and surveyors and God knows what. In a lot of other countries, that just doesn't exist. There is a very streamlined process, which is often completed within a month or so. It always feels like a bit of a cartel for these places to make money to me in this country.
And what you don't realise as well is that these bigger six, you know, house builders, they basically skip the local development plan in such a way that, you know, they apply for these, you know, these plots of lands to build all these thousands of houses prior to all this coming out. And, you know, what I've seen is that they don't go through the same due diligence as what I've had to do.
Yeah.
You know, all that they have people in the planning department. I'm not saying
they
do.
They know people.
Yeah, they know
they're used to. It's like a more charitable way of looking at it. It's they just know how to do it. It's used that, you know. It's like clockwork for them.
They do, and it's quite a shame, really, because you know we're trying to build smaller first time houses on this plot of land. You know, originally we had a plan of maybe just doing 15 executive houses, but we thought we'd change that just because of the scope of, you know, the way the world is at the moment. People are screaming out for first time properties. We said, okay, we'll change what we're actually going for, and you know, we're not getting absolutely anywhere. This planning process, the local development plan in South Wales and Cardiff, has been running for the last 5 years. And it's consultation after consultation after consultation. It's like what we're seeing in the mainstream government now. The amount of consultations they have to go through just to get something as simple as a development over the line.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's absolute madness, to be fair. And you know, Cardiff is an ever growing city. You know, just with, you know, with the bridge now being free to come over into Bristol, there's a lot of commuters travelling back and forth, with obviously because the house prices are a little bit less than where you would find in Bristol and Gloucester and places like that. You can't make it work if you wanted to, unless you've got the backing of, you know, a big name brand like Redrow or Taylor Wimpey or the main six. You can't get a look in, Lewis.
Luke, I'm grateful to you because again, you've encapsulated the problem perfectly. And you know, there are other countries to look to here. Recently in Japan, Tokyo, obviously it's a massive urban sprawl and we might not want to imitate it exactly, but they've got much looser planning rules, and guess what, they don't have a housing problem despite the fact how big and massive that city is. The United States, the cities and the states in the United States which are expanding most rapidly at the moment, they do tend to be the red states, southern states, which have fewer regulations, less burdensome rules and so on. Now yeah, of course we can say they've got more land to play with, but we can surely come to a better accommodation or a better compromise, a more flexible system than we have at the moment, which is one of the most tightly controlled systems for development anywhere in the world. And as we've been discussing, that doesn't benefit you. That actually benefits the rich and the powerful, because any bureaucratic system requires social capital, actual capital, knowledge, contacts to successfully and quickly navigate, which is something that most people, most small businesses do not possess. Ian is in Nutley in East Sussex. Ian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lewis. So I'm ringing up to try and put a slightly different complexion on what you've been saying.
Please.
And this is based on my experience as a local political activist and then latterly a local councillor on the district council where I live. So at the heart of the current planning system is the document called the National Planning Policy Framework, which is from the central government, and which, contrary to what some of your callers have been saying, actually puts local councils into quite a tight straitjacket when it comes to making planning decisions, which is why something like 90% of applications are approved, as your contributor from CPRE said when you started this item. But at the heart of that document is something called the viability test, and that is a guaranteed profit rate for developers of about 20%. And house building is the only sector of the national economy with a guaranteed profit rate, and with a system where if they can't get that profit rate, they can start cutting corners, not provide community gains.
And what's the justification for that, Ian?
I wish I knew. I mean, the practical justification is that the big companies give lots of money to the political parties.
Yeah.
They gave about 20% of the Conservative Party's national income over the last 12, 14 years. Then a couple of years ago, they saw that the wind was
presumably it's them who come forward and say, well, actually, for this reason or that reason or whatever, the 20% isn't being hit.
Yeah. And a lot of, I mean, the council I'm on is actually quite well resourced. And so we have the capacity to argue back and get experts in who can argue back. But a lot of councils don't because they're so cash strapped. And they basically have to take what developers say as gospel, because if they say no, there's an appeal to the planning inspector. And if they haven't got an expert on their side, the planning inspector will follow what the developer's expert says. Now, the consequence of that, sorry, this is important, is that about 70% of what is built is actually unaffordable to all but about 10% of the country.
Yes.
And that is the heart of the crisis. It's not so much numbers, it's what is being built and what is not being built. Now, I think housing should be based on need, not on not on wealth, and not on seeing it as an engine of economic growth primarily.
Yes.
But the way the system is structured at the moment, it will literally never meet the housing needs of people on the waiting lists up and down the country.
Yes.
We would need to have in our area, and we're a rural area and quite a wealthy area, we would need to have about twice as much so-called affordable housing produced by the system to get anywhere near meeting the demands of the people on our waiting list than the system allows us to provide.
All right.
That is year after year after year, with the result that masses of land have been wasted on producing large executive homes which don't sell. Furthermore, we've got 9,000 planning permissions that haven't even been started yet.
Okay. Ian, I'm grateful to you. I want to just very briefly get Ben from Ealing in, because he's been waiting very patiently. Only about a minute for you, Ben, so if you can express it crisply, then that will be wonderful.
I'll do my best. Just to say that part of the reason this government was elected was to do with sewage pollution and problems with our rivers. That's been a big electoral issue. Everyone's trying to do something about that. We've got the Mayor of London calling for clean London rivers. The biggest contributor, I think, to the pollution in London rivers comes from building. We've got a lot of buildings in London whose sewage is going directly into rivers, and that is as a result of failures in planning and building inspection and the construction industry. If we prioritise deregulating the building industry, we're going to have more of those kind of mistakes, and we're going to further damage the environment, which we all agree is important for the urban population's well-being. And nobody wants to live next to a stinking river. And, you know, the main cause of the reason why London's rivers are so polluted is bad building. So I think, you know, it's not about junking regulations. It's about sharpening them up and making them more precise and better targeted.
Well, Ben, I asked for crisp and you delivered crisp. So what more can you ask for? It's 12:59 and that is me done for another day. I'll be back tomorrow morning from 10 if you missed any of today's show. You can, of course, listen back on Catch Up on Global Player and the brand new LBC app, where you can stay up to date with all the latest news, opinion. You can put news categories in the order you want. You can pause, rewind live radio and listen to a range of podcasts. I can't think of which one might pique your interest, but I hear there's quite an obscure one about news there with some random guy who used to work in America. Download the all-new official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Ben Kentish, but now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lewis. At 3 today, Dame Helen Mirren says James Bond should always be played by a man. The logic she uses is the same logic that locked women out of many other roles in life for years. Tut tut, Dame Helen. Talk about that at 3. At 2, Birmingham Council has removed St George's and Union flags from streets, saying that they could put lives at risk. How so? Despite Palestinian flags flying across the city for several months. Is there a difference? Is there a double standard at play? And at 1, hastily arranged joint trip by European leaders to accompany President Zelensky to Washington has the feel of a last-ditch intervention to stop Putin and Trump shaping Europe's future unimpeded. What else could it be? What say you?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
from Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock. President Zelensky has accused Vladimir Putin of humiliating diplomatic efforts ahead of his meeting with Donald Trump later. 10 people have been killed in Ukraine by Russian strikes in Kharkiv and Zaporizhia. Lee Turner used to be Britain's ambassador to Ukraine. He's told LBC the meeting can't go much worse than Friday's summit between Trump and Putin in Alaska.
The one piece of good news that we have is that the Europeans, including Sir Keir Starmer, are arriving in force in Washington to back up President Zelensky in his talks with President Trump today. Now, why are they doing it? The principle that you can't change borders by force is fundamental to all of our security.
A 33-year-old man has been found guilty over the shooting of a 9-year-old girl and 3 men in East London last year. Javon Riley was convicted of attempted murder and grievous bodily harm as part of an attack driven by a long-running gang rivalry. He didn't fire the gun in Tottenham in May last year, but played a key role in orchestrating and implementing the plan. Politicians across Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales have urged Sir Keir Starmer to act now to put pressure on Israel to end the war in Gaza. In a letter led by the nationalist SDLP party, they say Parliament should be recalled and arms sales to Israel suspended. Thousands of people gathered in Tel Aviv yesterday to demonstrate against the conflict. Freelance journalist Noga Tarnopolsky, who's based in Jerusalem, has told LBC unrest is growing in Israel.
It was a wide-ranging Stop the War rally that was actually spearheaded by family members of people murdered on October 7th, 2023. But they were quickly joined by hostages' families and hundreds of thousands of sympathizers and, I think, general issue Israelis who are fed up with the situation.
Israel's prime minister has criticised the protests, saying they will only harden Hamas's stance. Sir Keir Starmer has said the UK will recognise a Palestinian state in September unless Israel takes steps to end the conflict. A man arrested after Bournemouth's Antoine Semenyo was racially abused has been released on bail. The forward says comments were made during his side's defeat to Liverpool at Anfield on Friday. And ministers are promising more patients in England will be able to get checks and scans out of hours. 100 community diagnostic centres are now staying open for longer as part of plans to improve access to healthcare. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 5 points at 91.33. The pound buys $1.35 and €1.15. LBC weather, plenty of sunshine in the west this afternoon, staying mostly cloudy further east. A few heavy and thundery showers in the southwest of England, highs of 26 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Sheila Fogarty.
Hello there, good afternoon to you. I'm going to look ahead to this meeting in Washington between a number of key European leaders, our own Prime Minister Keir Starmer included, alongside Vladimir Zelensky in the Oval Office. In Washington meeting Donald Trump. Here's the timeline. European leaders will go to the White House at 5 o'clock this evening, UK time, so just after I come off air, before Donald Trump then greets Vladimir Zelensky separately an hour later. Shortly after that, the Ukrainian president will brave the Oval Office once more, facing press questions as well, alongside Trump, without any of his European allies present. This, as you, I'm sure, remember, is what happened last time.
You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country, that's backed you far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Well, you might remember that that whole thing seemed to be sparked anyway by J.D. Vance. But as you heard there, Donald Trump waded in a full-throated way as well. Once the separate meetings have taken place, Donald Trump will gather the European leaders for what's called a family photo, group photo, at 7:30. This is our time, 7:30. And then to the East Room, where they'll all meet at 8 o'clock. This is the schedule. Who knows if it will be kept exactly to time, depending on how it all goes. That could be quite a difficult moment for everyone in Zelensky's corner, depending on what's happened and what Donald Trump intends to do. But I think it's fair to say that the European leaders going en masse like this at such short notice in the middle of the summer, it does suggest that they are, if not panicking, then at least very nervous indeed about precisely how Donald Trump is going to sit alongside Vladimir Putin in terms of decision making, and whether we in Europe, and particularly the Ukrainians, are going to have to just sit back and watch the whole situation be carved up by President Trump and President Putin. That will be very bad for Europe if that happens. Let's talk about this with Sir Robin Niblett, former director and chief executive of Chatham House. And we'll hear in a moment from Tom Rivers, American broadcaster and journalist. Sir Robin, first of all, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Sheila.
When you heard that this group of European leaders were all jumping on planes and going to Washington at the same time, essentially as a kind of support system for Volodymyr Zelensky, what did you think?
Well, the most obvious thing to think, and I suppose that I thought as well, is that they want to avoid a repeat of the February 28th debacle that you referred to a minute ago. Zelensky was left alone. If you might remember, he then left and flew directly to London, where everyone huddled together with him. And in a way, Zelensky and the European countries now form a unit. And one of the legacies of that terrible day in the Oval Office, 4 months, 6 months, 5 months ago, whatever it was, is that Europe knows that they cannot leave Trump alone with Zelensky. Zelensky doesn't want to be left alone with Trump either. And most importantly, this is because European security is going to be fundamentally affected by the type of deal, if there is a deal, done between Putin, Trump, and Zelensky. So it's not just a case of sort of standing up for him for moral reasons and making sure he's not left alone. They want to make sure that any deal that is done and is relevant for their security. Now, unlike February 28th, France and Britain at the very least, and a number of other countries represented there, said they will provide their own security guarantees or assurances by perhaps having troops on the ground and so on. So there is a sense now that Zelensky plus the European leaders form a unit. And so they want to make sure that Trump understands you can't play one off against the other.
And is this as much as anything about that new unit? But, you know,